family. It's time to switch over to him for everybody, including me. Thanks for your contributions this evening, your ideas, your thoughts, your calls, your emails. And thank you to those of you especially, or not especially, but also who listen to the program in delay after Malloy, who then share your thoughts with us. I really do appreciate that. Thanks for the encouragement and the reinforcement. It's important because this is one of those mediums where this is one of those media where you can't see the audience out beyond the footlights, and they don't line up with the red carpet. So feedback is really, really good, and reinforcement and positive reinforcement really works on me. So that's not me being desperate. That's me being appreciative. I've got several emails talking about how people were snorting various liquids out of their noses when I was making light of conservative humorist Matt Labash. And I've got another example of that, so maybe we'll find time for it tomorrow night during prayer meeting. So thanks again to everybody. Thanks to John Fox and Peter Godbold and Ben Birch. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and coalriverwind.org. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you.
And a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Welcome to this Tuesday night edition of The Horn, and we're going to get right to business because, well, there's breaking news in the coal fields, and it's in its way heartbreaking breaking news. Here in a few minutes, we will be talking with archaeologist Dr. Harvard Ayers, professor emeritus of archaeology and anthropology at Appalachian State University in Boone, North Carolina. Dr. Harvard Ayers has been instrumental in the fight to save one of America's most needed and most neglected historic sites. I'm talking about, of course, Blair Mountain in southern West Virginia. Most of you most likely know the story of Blair Mountain. You know how working people who were, for lack of a better term, and I don't know that there is one, who were enslaved by the rising coal industry in this state. By the end of the second decade of the 20th century, had become fed up with the idea that they were fit for nothing more than bond servants of a coal industry that treated them as something
less than human. As such, eventually these working people pushed to the absolute breaking point, marched. They were marching toward Logan, West Virginia, the seat of all that was evil and unholy in what the coal industry was trying to do to keep, at that time, working people under their thumbs and in a state of utter terror and absolute repression. These are not idle words. What preceded the armed march on Logan? Matewan preceded the armed march on Logan. The murder of Sheriff Sid Hatfield on the courthouse steps by gun thugs on the courthouse steps of McDowell County, West Virginia, preceded the armed march on Logan. The New River Coal Wars preceded the armed march on Logan. The Bull Moose Special, in which the coal companies hired a train to literally go down Paint Creek Holler, machine gunning everything in sight, preceded the march on Logan. And it came to a head not at Logan, but at Blair Mountain. Coal miners who recently had been involved in what they were told was a fight to make the world safe for democracy in Europe took up arms again as they marched. They were met at Blair Mountain by the unholy host of corporate coal company gun thugs, aided and abetted by the state government and the federal government. They entrenched and they were attacked. This story should be taught in every American history class in the United States from 8th grade up. 8th grade is the year when West Virginia kids learn West Virginia history. And there is barely a word about the rise of the labor movement in this state or the struggle for fundamental basic human rights in West Virginia. I should know. I've got an 8th grader studying for the Golden Horseshoe exam now. He has heard nothing of Blair Mountain. Fast forward in time. Blair Mountain, where the federal government, the United States military, at the urging of one Billy Mitchell, who would go down in infamy, sent its fledgling Air Force carrying bombs to drop bombs on working Americans. Blair Mountain receded into the dim mists of time to a certain extent, remembered but not remembered. The fledgling union movement in West Virginia following Blair Mountain was crushed until, in the midst of the Great Depression, the National Labor Relations Act was passed and collective bargaining was legalized as a matter of statutory law. Now, consider that for a moment. Back up. The only time in the history of the Republic when aircraft have been used to bomb a civilian force, a group of civilians, the first time was at Blair Mountain, Let that settle in for a moment. Consider, if you will, a continuum. Whenever, well, Blair Mountain, Blair Mountain was the start of something in this country. And it was not the start of something good. Blair Mountain, you know, they say that the first step, the journey of 1,000 miles begins with one step. And so it was with the Battle of Blair Mountain. With those first few bombs dropped from aircraft on working people, poor people, desperate people at Blair Mountain, the United States began with the first step of a long and sad journey. That took us to the firebombing of Dresden, or the approval of it and its civilian population, the firebombing of Tokyo and its civilian population, the atomic attacks on Nagasaki and Hiroshima and their civilian populations. It is a continuum that extends through the napalm fire attacks on civilian villages in Vietnam, through the obliteration and death of upwards of 1.3 million non-combatant civilian human beings in mud brick huts and homes in Iraq, through to similar bombings on peasant villages and wedding parties with predator drone aircraft in Afghanistan, and into those predator drone aircraft attacks stealthily and surreptitiously in Pakistan and Yemen. And so when you see news that another wedding party has been obliterated, or another group of school children has been reduced to its constituent molecular parts, thousands upon thousands of miles away from the United States, do us a favor here in the hills and hollers, and remember that the attitude that says they're only fill in the blank started at Blair Mountain. It's a hell of a journey. And I've told you time and time again how difficult it is to hang on to our heritage and our culture here in Appalachia, because it is constantly under attack and subject to erasure by the coal companies and the government officials who are owned by the coal companies. Well, that job got a little more difficult. Because while Blair Mountain had been added to the Register of Historic Places, well, not so much. It has been officially delisted from the Register of Historic Places. In a tableau that is absolutely absolutely stunning. In its perfidy. Here in a couple of minutes, we will be joined, as I said, by Appalachian State University Professor Emeritus Dr. Harvard Ayers. And he will tell the story of what has happened of late and what amounts to, for all intents and purposes, not the Battle of Blair Mountain, but the battle for Blair Mountain. The effort to save our heritage. The effort to save our culture and what is being done to counter those efforts. So we'll go to a little musical interlude. And I'll get Dr. Ayers on the phone. This is the horn.
And there's not so much as one little square inch. They don't have enough money to buy.
I have on the phone with me Dr. Harvard Ayers, archaeologist, mountain activist, dare I say, and I am pleased to have him join us. Dr. Ayers, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Welcome to the program, and let me just start by saying thank you for the efforts that you have made on behalf of Blair Mountain. Back in 2006, you were moved to do some archaeological research on Blair Mountain, and you had a dig there. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. Actually, what I found out was that a previous attempt to get the site listed on the National Register had fallen a little short. They basically needed some archaeological corroboration to back up the excellent history, which Barbara Rasmussen and others have put together on the 1921 battle, and so I went out and started in February, but did most of my work in the summer. And yes, I wouldn't actually call it a dig because we didn't dig a lot, but we did find a lot of artifacts through various means.
So more of a surface collection then?
Yes, sir, effectively, because what we did was we'd come upon an area where we expected something would be there, and I was led in all cases by Logan County resident Kenny King, who has been to all these sites on his four-wheeler up there on the ridge, and he would show me where it was, and then we'd start using metal detectors, and what we'd usually find are the shell casings that were fired, maybe 30-06s or 30-30s or shotguns or pistols, and then we'd have to take a couple of inches of leaf mold off to get down to them, so it was more like a surface collection.
Okay, and you identified how many sites then?
We actually identified a total of 14 sites that were separate places, separated by usually 100 more yards, along this 10-mile stretch of ridge. Those 14 sites, each one of them contained considerable evidence of the battle.
So shell casings, did you find anything more personal than that?
Well, we did in fact find a pistol. And that was about the most exciting find. Interestingly, it wasn't found at one of these sites. It was kind of a random find as we happened to be walking through the woods, is that our metal detector lit up, and there it was. And the reason that was the case is that word has it when the attacking Union miners had to leave when the federal troops came in, they took off and ditched their guns, and I think a lot of them kind of buried them and planned to come back. But some guy ditched,
that's quite all right.
Ditched a .32 caliber Smith & Wesson pistol, and we found it some 80 years later.
And did it fit contextually with the time?
Oh, yes. This is very much of a period weapon, this particular Smith & Wesson.
Let me just ask you. I realize archaeology being a science, but this being a very emotional place as well. Were you able to, with what you did, how can I put this? Get a sense of the place, get a feel for the people, because you know whether it's a kitchen midden with a bunch of broken pottery and fish bones or whatever. One of the beauties of archaeology lies in the fact that it makes things that look otherwise meaningless meaningful.
Definitely. Let's say, for instance, take the one site which we found on the south crest of Blair Mountain itself. It was up above the gap that Highway 17 goes through there between the north and south crests of Blair Mountain. And the defenders, the Logan forces, so to speak, had dug little pox holes for themselves, and we could almost see the 200 yards down to the gap, but that was easy distance for those 30-06s that they had. And you could just imagine those folks lying there and in the protection of their foxholes and firing down at the approaching miners.
How big, you said a 10-mile ridge. So roughly how many acres are we talking about?
We're talking about in the range of 1,700 acres that encapsulates all this ridge as it winds through the countryside. It's certainly not a straight line, but that's about it. About 1,700 total acres was the battle site.
And the purpose of your survey, as you noted, was to sort of shore up an application to put Blair Mountain on the National Register of Historic Places. That also involved finding out who owned the land and so forth?
Yes, sir. As a matter of fact, it did. And there was an early study done back in, after we did our archaeological work, the study was done by the Attorney General's Office of the state of West Virginia. And they searched the tax records down in Logan County. And they got a list of owners, and then they had some people that had submitted objection letters, and that was the basis of a part of the checking out everything to see if it was gonna fly.
Okay, and so eventually, just to try to make this process, okay, let me back up. What is the process of getting something listed on the National Register?
Well, basically, anybody can make an application to the state, and usually a person called the state historic preservation officer, Randall Reed Smith in the case of West Virginia, then takes that application, and of course it's his various people that work in his department that take a close look at it, the archaeologist and so forth, with whom I worked really closely, and then they look at it and see if they feel that it is significant enough, and certainly the history records already show that this was a very significant battle. And the archaeological remains, which were quite intact, really showed that this was an important site. It wasn't all disturbed by logging roads or any other activity. So once that was the case, then the State Archives and History Commission met and gave their unanimous approval of a recommendation that it be listed on the National Register of Historic Places by the National Park Service, and so then they forwarded it on to the Park Service.
And the Park Service then moved, and if I understand correctly, Blair Mountain was added to the National Register of Historic Places on March the 30th, 2009. Is that correct?
Exactly.
And that involves a federal official who is referred to generically as the keeper. Is that correct?
That's correct. Uh-huh.
So we've got national recognition. We've got, and the entire process was gone through. Is there anything in what you know to suggest that it was not gone through properly?
Well, as we found out later, the state, after they put in their initial recommendation, came back with a change that actually didn't get to the keeper until a few days after March 30th. It was a letter of April 6th in which they said, well, we thought when we first had our Attorney General do the studies of the tax records that there were less people who signed objection letters than there were people who actually did not and wanted the site to be listed. They were property owners, of course. Well, in this April 6th letter, the SHPO said, hey, there are more objectors now that we found these 8 objection letters lying on our desk. They somehow got lost. And so they recommended that it be taken off of the list of the National Register of Historic Places and only considered eligible for that list. So that was something which we weren't really pleased with.
I can well imagine. So with that in mind, you then in turn took it upon yourself to try to look at this list of objectors. And I guess maybe good background on this is, what does designation as a on the National Historic Register do to a property owner's rights with regard to that property?
You know, it actually does nothing. I mean, it doesn't restrict anything, as long as there's not some big construction project which would really harm the remains of the battle. But they can do anything else as long as they let someone know that they're going to and can get a permit, just like if you have to have a building permit from the county. This would possibly be part of the project. But, you know, people can still do pretty much everything that they want to do. I think there's a lot of false information out there, and my suspicion is that it's possible that the coal companies, when they went and solicited these letters of objection, told people some things that might not have been totally true, like they couldn't paint their barn a different color or different things like this to get them to go ahead and sign that they object, and we were really bothered by that.
Imagine a coal company doing something like
that.
Imagine. Yeah, forgive me, Dr. Ayers, I'm a bit of a cynic at this point.
Well, yeah.
But it would interfere with the ability to blow up the mountain in toto, would it not?
Yes. Either whether it's listed or whether it's considered eligible, either one would trigger a certain federal process when a permit is requested to blow the mountain up for mountaintop removal, and there would have to be a check to see if it's going to actually harm any remains that might be there of the battle. So, yes, it would give it that kind of protection. However, it doesn't mean that they couldn't still blow it up if they did something to mitigate the effects. And I don't know how you soften the effects of blowing a mountain up.
Well, we had the authors of the Science Magazine study on last Friday, and they sort of made it abundantly clear from a scientific perspective that the idea of mitigating the damaging effects of mountaintop removal is sort of a fool's errand.
One of my friends up there one time told me that it was like putting lipstick on a corpse to think that there could be some kind of a mitigation of a mountaintop removal site.
That's basically our understanding. let me take this further then, and sort of keep the timeline within comprehension. So at this point, you're presented with these eight extra letters that just sort of, like you said, well, darn, it was under the Sears catalog on the desk, and there they are, and now there's more objectors than there are non-objectors. What did you do then?
Well, I thought that it would be a good idea, there's one more step in here that we've got to talk about, and that's that the keeper of the National Register took it upon himself to take this April 6th letter and declare his intent to take the site off of the list, since they had found more objectors than non-objectors. And that was in July. So as soon as I heard that in July, I did swing into action here and went down to the Logan County Courthouse and started taking a look at some of the deeds for these objectors, and very shortly hired an attorney that is a real estate attorney from Charleston, West Virginia, and John Bailey. And he came down there and did his own search. So basically the idea was to tell if indeed their data were correct and there were more objectors than there were property owners who did not object.
And by the way, I know John Kennedy Bailey. He's a fine fellow.
Yes.
So what was the upshot of Lawyer Bailey's research?
Well, the upshot was that of these 30 people that they said that wrote objection letters, two of them were dead.
Well, that's quite a feat.
Well, yeah, if you can do it.
I mean, you can build a religion around that, Doc.
Since 1983 was his death date, and his daughter had signed the letter with his name, and then underneath it said by his daughter. But dead men can't own property, and dead men can't sign letters. So then the other one was a guy that had died in 2008, and he was no longer a landowner, and so he's, you know, we figured that wasn't such a good idea either.
You know, it is grimly humorous that the dead are up to their old tricks again in Logan County. You know, we had decades upon decades, Dr. Ayers, where they voted regularly.
Oh my.
The thing that bothers me about this is not some. Okay, so you uncovered some arguably dodgy information there, but you didn't stop there, and you persisted in your efforts with both the keeper and the director of SHPO. What happened?
Well, let me say, too, it wasn't just the two dead people. We also found that two of the people listed as objectors who signed letters, who were quite alive, apparently, were what are called life estate holders. Of course, that means that you own the property, you can live there till you die, and then it reverts back to someone else. But life estate owners are not fee simple title holders, so those two life estates could not possibly be objectors. So now we've already got four, two dead and two life estates. Then we found 13 more landowners that had not even been discovered by the cursory process that the West Virginia Attorney General had put in place. So their study was fraught with errors.
So at this point, we're down four for sure, and 13 to the good. So that means, and whenever I do math on the fly on this program, it's Katie bar the door. But that sounds like we're nine to the good at this point, Dr. Ayers.
Yeah, we're a little bit more than that, because we found one other person who had actually sold their property several years before. So it was a really shoddy job by the Attorney General, and we were ahead by maybe 10, 11, something like that.
So at this point, it seems to me it would be a no-brainer. You go back and you correct that SHPO here in West Virginia goes back and corrects the errors. But that didn't happen, did it?
Well, it didn't happen. And what we did was, we put our comments in within the allotted comment period on the intent to delist by the keeper. And the keeper then forwarded our work, or actually asked me to, and I did. I forwarded not only our work, our letter, from the attorney, but also all the relevant deeds and tax records and death records of these two dead people. And we forwarded those to the SHPO, and then the keeper told the SHPO that it was their job to study these comments of mine and my attorney's, and they just said no, they wouldn't do it.
Did they offer a rationale, a reason, anything?
No, the rationale was that they made the first determination, but in this delisting, since it was initiated by the keeper, it wasn't a petition from the SHPO, West Virginia SHPO, to delist. It was just simply a letter saying, we just wanted you to know we noted these additional eight objection letters. So they washed their hands of it and just said, this is what you need to evaluate this, Mr. Keeper. We're not going to do it.
And did the keeper do that?
No, the keeper says that this has to be done by West Virginia attorneys because they don't have any there in Washington. And so they said, this is not our job to evaluate it. So they wrote another letter and said, we strongly recommend that you review Ayers' comments. And the SHPO again came back with a letter on December 8th, just a month ago, saying that, no, we're not going to do it for the same reasons. And that was it.
So as of now, it is officially delisted.
Correct. As of December 30th, that was the day that the keeper delisted it, despite review and evaluation of the comments which I made, which would have turned the whole thing around.
Is there a legal remedy to this sort of thing, Doctor?
Well, there possibly is. There may be some federal remedies, and we haven't looked at all of our avenues of approach yet, so I'd rather not talk too much about it. But there are some potential legal remedies which we're investigating at this time, since it was just a week ago or so that this all came down.
When you examined the list of objectors, were there any common threads? Did you see that, as it were, the unseen hand of the coal company working? I realize that's somewhat speculative, but.
Well, we did see that the same notary public apparently notarized several different signatures in several different areas of Logan County on the same day. So they were clearly going around and talking to these people, and we actually didn't have to see their hand because we were told by one individual whose name I won't mention at the moment, but who was one who would not sign an objection letter. He thought it was a great idea, as most of the landowners did, to have the National Register site. And he said he was approached, and some friends of his were approached, and in many cases the coal companies were telling them the wrong story and tried to scare them into signing these letters. So certainly there was a strong coal industry presence in this attempt to get these people to object.
You've done considerable battlefield work over the course of your career. Is that correct?
I have done some, yes, sir.
I've tried to convey in the beginning of the program the importance of Blair Mountain to the folks who share their time and listen to the horn. But within the realm of your expertise, why is this site important?
Well, look at it this way. Even though most people in the United States have never heard of Blair Mountain, there were 5 days of intense battles and 15,000 combatants. There were about 10,000 Union miners and about 4,000 or 5,000, defenders, the Logan forces that didn't want the miners to unionize. And they fought with machine guns, with 30-aught sixes and 30-30s and pistols and shotguns and everything they could find in their closet, I guess. We don't know exactly how many people were killed, but the most important thing, perhaps, is that since our Civil War, which, of course, ended in 1865, this is the largest insurrection in our country. And so it has a great national significance here and is certainly the largest of all of the what are called Cold Wars or coal field wars, meaning in the coal fields, although there were other battles at places like Cabin Creek and Paint Creek and so forth between the unions and the managers of the coal mines. But this was the largest of all those labor insurrections at that point. So it's quite significant on just about any scale.
And if there's no mountain there anymore, they're going to be hard-pressed to put up a historical marker on it, aren't they?
Well, yeah. And it ought to be a lot more than a historical marker. Ideally, we would like to see this established as a unit of the National Park Service. Probably something like a national monument, like many important historical sites are. I mean, how about the Battle of Gettysburg? This isn't as important as that, but it certainly comes close. I mean, you've got all these incredible things that happened, not just those 15,000 combatants, but give me just a moment and I'll explain it.
Take all the time you need.
There were 21 airplanes of the U.S. Air Force at that time, called the Army Air Corps, which the famous General Billy Mitchell of Second World War as well as First World War fame flew his planes down there. They didn't bomb the miners, the unionizing miners, but they did fly reconnaissance for the coal companies and for the defenders from Logan. And this was the only case that I know of in U.S. history where our own Air Force, or in this case Army Air Corps, was used against our own citizens, 10,000 of our own citizens. And then, of course, the thing that actually ended the battle in September 4th or 5th of 1921 was the governor of West Virginia calling in the federal troops. And that's when the miners did their exit and hid their guns and so forth, which I mentioned.
And they literally called in the United States Army.
Yeah.
To put down. And the outflow of that whole event, there were individuals charged with treason against the state of West Virginia, were there not?
Yes, there were. There were several that were charged with treason. There was a minister and his son, and, of course, Bill Blizzard, the famous leader of the unionizing miners, was charged. And I think only one person out of that whole crowd of 10,000 people was convicted. And there really wasn't much to convict them on. I mean, what do you say, you know, when you're trying to get better working conditions in the mines so that you won't get killed by a rock fall and trying to get a little bit more than 2 cents an hour or whatever they were, that's ridiculous, but trying to get a little bit better pay and certainly better health conditions, black lung, those kinds of things. Why would you want to send one to jail for trying to get better working conditions?
And it was important to the federal government at that time, was it not, to make as little of this as possible, lest the idea spread?
Well, I think so, and it was a little bit hard to do because, of course, they had the Air Force and the army coming down here, but they were hopeful it would just kind of all go away. But remember that the New York Times, the biggest newspaper in our country, reported on this above the fold on the front page. That's prime space for several days in a row. I mean, this actually got fairly good attention at that point. But since then, the unions or the owners, the coal industry and so forth, has tried to quiet it up. They just don't want it to be known what happened then.
And that's that was actually where I was leading to, Doctor. What role does historic preservation play in the character and the heritage of a region?
Well, I think in this case, when you figure out that there were 10,000 men that came together to basically fight for a good cause, better working conditions for themselves, I think this just shows the determination. And they're fighting against better armed people up on a high ridge that are firing down at them. I think it shows the determination of the mountain people of West Virginia, which is a long, revered characteristic which folks should know about West Virginians. And it's just a great deal of force of character on the part of these people to go into battle for these good causes.
You mentioned earlier that you would like to see some sort of national monument status, and of course that's one of the oldest of the national protective statutes. I believe it did come in the administration of Theodore Roosevelt, or at least shortly thereafter. Is there any design work or any talk going on as to what sort of visualization there would be at Blair Mountain if it could be accomplished?
Well, to tell the truth, we're just kind of hanging on now for dear life because we hope that our efforts will reverse the delisting and get it listed back on the register. So we pretty much got our hands full there. But once we get to where we can breathe a little easier, which I thought we had when we first got it listed, then we can start thinking about better things.
Is there anything at this stage of the process that private citizens can do?
You know, I would say that they could definitely get in touch with any of their congresspeople and ask them to ask the National Park Service, why is this happening? And we're going to have more of what I would suggest is this. We've got a website, and it's friendsofblairmountain.com. And people can go on that to see a summary of what I've been talking about today, and then there will be alerts for anyone that really cares about this, that will give them more specific information, because this has all happened so quickly, we're not quite ready to rally the supportive folks that like this, love this mountain, and want to do something to save it. But that will definitely come within the next couple of weeks.
Is there a time pressure vis-a-vis anything the coal companies might do in terms of permitting processes or anything?
Well, there's already a couple of permits on the south end down there by the South Crest and coming up the entranceway there where the miners actually approached up a creek called White Trace Branch to the South Crest when they came up in 1921. And there's already some coal company activity there. It's actually part of the delisted site. And I don't know whether their permits took into account the archaeology or not, but I've seen it and I'm very concerned. So we're going to try to get some more information into the state archaeologists to tell them what we think is being perhaps destroyed by the current activities of the miners.
And I'm getting a question out of our chat room here asking, Dr. Ayers, does it matter as far as notifying my congressperson and whatnot if I'm not in West Virginia?
Oh, no, not at all. You could just notify your congressperson that this is something which you really oppose and you're very favorable to protecting Blair Mountain, and just ask them to give a call over to the or send a letter to the National Park Service, to the keeper, and ask them what's going on here. How come you delisted this site? I mean, that's the generic answer. Like I say, we're going to have a lot more focused campaign within, I'd say, 2 weeks. But that would be just my general suggestion.
Let me go a couple of other places, if I may, quickly, Doctor. One of them being, you also have a Facebook fan page, Friends of Blair Mountain, because that's where I get my information. And folks can sign up on that. The force of numbers always does matter. And you know, maybe somebody's got a congressman who's very pro-labor. This is labor history, and the eradication of labor history is something that we should take very, very seriously, because I think that is the intent behind this. This is an erasure. With that in mind, has the United Mine Workers of America taken any position on this?
Yes, they actually are in favor of the listing. And so that's the position that Cecil Roberts et al. Took officially, is that they support our efforts.
Okay. Well, that's at least hopeful. And let me run a bit of field here, because you said you didn't know what the archaeological impacts were, and of course archaeology, especially in this region, goes back far beyond white folks coming here.
Yes.
And we've got a pretty good idea of what this area was like and what it was used for prior to the coming of white people. If, for instance, I mean, there are laws out there, are there not? I mean, if you're gonna put through a 4-lane highway and somewhere along the way you find something of archaeological significance, doesn't it have to be studied before you can go on?
Well, yes. The actual requirement is that if you're going to have anything that disturbs the ground, like let's say a 4-lane highway, something like Corridor G or the Interstate 77 or something like that, you've got to go through a federal process, because it's a federal project and has federal monies involved, and it has to be approved. And one of the approvals is to actually have what's called a survey. Archaeologists go into the field and check out the places that might have archaeological sites, and that's done before any of the earth moving is done. And then if some of those sites are significant, like all of these on Blair Mountain were, then if there's going to be any disturbance of them, then they certainly have to be looked at very, very closely before anything that might be done to destroy them. The point being that it doesn't give you a lock on preservation, but you certainly will at least find out what part of history is having the pages ripped out of the history books. So,
well, do any of those statutes apply to private actions, say, of a coal company blowing up a mountain?
Sure, because there's all kinds of Corps of Engineers has to give a permit approval for every one of the permits, and also, of course, the DEP has to, and there are federal and state processes which would then trigger a search for archaeological remains in an area that was going to be destroyed in some way.
Well, I ask because I have never heard of a coal company or the DEP or the Corps of Engineers requiring that kind of work on these massive mountaintop removal operations.
Well, they actually do, and the coal companies have an archaeological consultant, which always does their work. Magically, they never find any particularly significant remains, even though they may or may not be there. But these folks go out, and we call them archaeostitutes, and they actually go out there and don't find anything.
Anything
on Blair Mountain either, but that's obviously not the case.
About one step above pot hunters?
Oh, probably not. Worse. Pot hunters at least don't destroy the sites, but they hired one of these people to contest my work and say that my work was not done well. And that person, that archaeologist, came down from Northern Virginia and met with the Archives and History Commission when we got full approval and attacked my work. She went out of there crying practically, because it was obvious that her attacks were just nothing but just smokescreen, basically. And my work was basically exonerated, and the whole commission voted that they would recommend that it be listed.
You know, I ask these questions, Dr. Ayers, because there are homes all over West Virginia that have little wooden boxes that are filled with cotton that have, you know, the spear points, arrow points, scrapers, hammers, hatchet heads, whatever, you know, behind glass that have been found in surface collections, literally all over this state.
Right.
And it astonishes me, you know, we've got, just because of the conversations that I have with folks who are affected by mountaintop removal, There are stories. There's a mountaintop removal job slated near something that is at least anecdotally been passed down as a slave cemetery.
Right.
There are other people who have told me of up on Coal River Mountain, for instance, what are anecdotally said to be known the Amerindian burial sites.
Sure. Yeah, I wouldn't doubt it.
Because if we look at, and I was really, really taken, I don't know if you read it or not, I was taken with a book by Charles C. Mann a few years back called 1491, in which he talked about the population numbers that existed here prior to the arrival of white people. And it was a mind-blowing, eye-opening experience. And suddenly you understand how it is that, you know, a guy walking through a freshly plowed cornfield or whatever, it can come away with 5 or 6 points.
Well, that's right. People have been living here for 10, 20,000 years before the first Columbus voyage or whatever. You're going to have a buildup. In some cases, a site might have different stratigraphic layers. The deeper you dig, the older you go. And you might have cultures represented for each millennium, each thousand-year period, you know, going right on through history.
And once they're gone...
Yeah, you know, it's kind of like ripping pages out of the only history book in the world when you go to destroy an archaeological site, because you've totally destroyed that history. It's unique history.
I certainly appreciate your time this evening, and I thank you for going afield with me as well.
Oh, sure.
I'm a bad, bad, bad old archaeo geek. As I mentioned in our email exchange, had it not been for physical anthropology, that was my major at one time, but I couldn't understand the guy doing the bone section of the class. Bailed on a whole major. But I love it, and it's so valuable, and it is so telling about, you know, and the thing is, I guess when you just do this willy-nilly and you destroy these things, you don't even necessarily know what you're losing because you haven't had a chance to study it.
That's exactly right. That's why the analogy with ripping the pages out of the only history book in the world.
And we are by far the worst for it. I wish you the absolute best in your ongoing efforts, Doctor. If we can be of any help whatsoever, let us know when the updates start coming. I hope folks will have signed up for the notifications there at friendsofblairmountain.com. And just the absolute best to you, Dr. Ayers, and thank you very much for the time you've taken with us this evening.
Bob, what if I give you an update as soon as I figure out what we're going to be doing? I'll let you know. Maybe you can mention it on your program, and we'll have it on Friends of Blair Mountain, and so maybe we can facilitate it that way.
That would be wonderful, Dr. Ayers. Thank you very kindly, and a very good evening to you.
You have a good evening, too. Bye-bye.
Now. Dr. Harvard Ayers, Professor Emeritus of Archaeology and Anthropology at Appalachian State University in Boone, North Carolina. You know, oddly enough, their school mascot is the Mountaineers, too. Am I shallow? But no, this matters. This is your history. I don't care where you are. If you are an American, this is your history. God knows if you are a member of a union. This is your history. It's not a UMWA issue. It is a labor issue. And I don't think there is a more real, more visceral example of the idea of corporate America erasing our very essence, our very nature, than what's going on at Blair Mountain. You heard Dr. Ayers. The permits are already issued for a chunk of this. And when it's gone, it's gone. And then they can say, oh, Blair Mountain, no, they exaggerated that. There weren't 10,000 miners there rising up to stand up for themselves and protect themselves against predatory capitalism. Oh, no, you know, it was a little handful of ne'er-do-wells. Donald Rumsfeld call dead-enders. Nothing really happened there. They were happy little slaves mining away in the bowels of the earth, getting blown up in gas explosions and crushed under slate falls. Nothing happened. It didn't happen. It wasn't there. And you know what? When they erase that, they're not just erasing the past. It's like a fading photograph. and you were in the background of that photograph. And you're going to fade too. Because what they can do then, they can what they can do now, they can do later. So by all means, do please go to friendsofblairmountain.com. Sign up for the updates. I will keep you updated as I find out what's going on. And I hope that, for all of our sakes, I hope that Blair Mountain can become a living memorial of the never-ending, from the moment we came down out of the trees, the never-ending struggle of the working many to have some form of human decency against the owning and abusing few. Now I've got chills. Not from me, but from what Dr. Ayers said. Wow. Just wow. Can you imagine that? This is something a little bit past they paved paradise and put up a parking lot. This is more along the lines of they blew up our heritage and pretended we didn't exist. 10,000 fathers, 10,000 brothers, 10,000 sons. And the one thing they had in common was that they were working men. 10,000, 20,000, 30,000 conversations around kitchen tables, clad in oilcloth by lantern light. 10,000 weeping mothers, 10,000 worried wives, knowing that for them and their children and everything they hoped for down the generational lines, it might well all come to an end or in some form be decided when their coal mining veteran husbands walked out the door, got on a horse, maybe took a train, or just walked as they'd been walking all their lives. For some semblance of human dignity, human rights. So that's where the first hour comes to an end. Coming up, we have the Green News Report with Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen. And after that, the second hour. This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. This is The Horn.
sick and lost, and man, I'm thinking blue. Big family blue, boys, feel family blue. Homesick and lost, and man, I'm thinking blue. I'm home, I'm home, girl.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
It's Tuesday, January 12, 2010.
I don't want the industries that yield the jobs of tomorrow to be built overseas.
New initiative for green jobs in the U.S. New study says no to mountaintop removal. Newsflash, it's cold in winter. Somebody alert Fox News.
All of that and more straight ahead. I'm Brad Friedman of BradBlog.com.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Prepare for 6 minutes of green news, politics, analysis, and yes, snarky comments.
International Falls in Minnesota yesterday had a recorded temperature of 37 degrees below zero. Yeah, that global warming thing's really kicking into high gear, isn't it?
Hey, Steve Ducey of Fox News. You used to be a weatherman. Do you not know the difference between weather and climate? Apparently not. This is your Green News Report. The Green News Report is brought to you by VelvetRevolution.us. It's now officially another big election year, and VR is continuing their years-long fight against failed and faulty electronic voting systems. Fight the fight along with VR by signing on to the Diebold Return Our Money campaign. It's free and your voice makes a difference. Sign on at DieboldReturnOurMoney.com to continue the fight for free, fair, accurate, and transparent elections in 2010. All right, Desi Doyen, well, apparently you don't really need to know anything to be the anchor of a major morning network news show.
It's true.
Steve Ducey proves that, doesn't
it? Well, yeah, the Fox News Morning Show Brain Trust has made a startling discovery.
Yes, wait a minute. Let me put it in a way that they will understand it. This is a Fox News alert.
It's cold in winter.
Well done.
While the Fox News crew pondered this discovery, climate scientists have been busy this week trying to explain how the record cold snap in the U.S. does not undermine the overall global trend of warming, patiently explaining that even with climate change, local temperatures will continue to be colder in winter and warmer in summer.
Wait, let me get that straight. It's colder in winter and it's warmer in summer.
Yes.
Got it.
Shocking.
All right.
Weather refers to short-term local conditions. Climate refers to long-term trends of the global climate system. But the current cold, of course, is in keeping with predictions from climate scientists who predicted during the Bush administration that the overall warming trend would continue to lead to more frequent, intense, and extreme weather events.
So just because it's cold in my backyard
does not mean the globe is cooling. Am I correct on that?
Well, you know, now might be a good time to point out that other areas in the world are experiencing a warm winter, like the exotic locale of Alaska, which recorded record highs this week. Also, the Mediterranean, Africa, and even Canada, where preparations for next month's Winter Olympics in Vancouver are struggling due to lack of snow, where temperatures are too warm to use snowmaking equipment, and they're stockpiling snow at higher elevations to be trucked in.
Seriously, I need a job at Fox News.
Through this initiative, we're awarding $2.3 billion in tax credits for American manufacturers of clean energy technologies.
The White House announced two big moves in the last week to promote clean energy manufacturing and fuel efficiency. As you just heard, President Obama announced an initiative to boost the U.S. manufacturing sector in clean energy to create jobs. The $2.3 billion in tax credits will be matched with funding from private sources to boost the clean energy companies that manufacture inside the U.S. The White House estimates the initiative will create 17,000 new jobs. The president also stressed the need to close the clean energy gap for the U.S. to catch up on clean energy technologies. And, of course, right on cue, eSolar, a solar energy company in the U.S., yesterday announced a deal to build a massive solar farm in China.
But, yeah, and let me tell you what, the skeptics out there who are skeptical about renewable energy, China ain't skeptical. They are investing billions into this technology. They're investing billions into this technology here in the U.S. It's about time that the U.S. caught up with China here in our own backyard, where it's really cold, by the way.
And also, on Monday, the Department of Energy awarded nearly $200 million in grants for research into improving fuel efficiency for cars and trucks.
Well, about damn time.
Now, you've probably heard about the movie Avatar. It's broken box office records around the world and is now the most profitable opening weekend ever. Now, you'd think that that sort of profit would please free market conservatives, but they're very upset because the film Avatar presents a story of environmental protection versus industrial mining profits. The not-at-all-veiled plot of the film has even some wingnut bloggers claiming it's a training film for eco-terrorists.
Right, like the Teletubbies and Tiki Winky are training for being gay. Has anybody mentioned these people are nuts?
And in keeping with the theme of Avatar, a new study bolsters the effort to end the destructive coal mining technique of mountaintop removal, in which the tops of mountains are literally blown off to get at the juicy coal inside, dumping the debris into valleys and streams below. This blockbuster new study says blowing up mountains is, surprisingly, bad for mountains.
Who'd have thunk it?
Published in the journal Science, these scientists say the data shows, quote, the environmental impact of mountaintop removal is pervasive and irreversible, and mitigation cannot compensate for losses. And the scientists call for the EPA to halt all permits immediately for mountaintop removal.
Read about that and much more at our website, greennews.bradblog.com. Download us on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report. Steve Ducey. Cooler.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95?
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at CityNet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit CityNet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head-on with Bob Kincaid.
Six minutes past the hour. You know the phone numbers, 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head-on. On your nickel, it's 304-658-3333. Email rolls into Bob Kincaid, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D, at gmail.com. And I again encourage any and all of you to sign up for alerts at friendsofblairmountain.com. And look for Friends of Blair Mountain on Facebook as well. Makes it kind of handy that way. And without any further ado, let's go straight to the phones. Brian is with us, as you may have heard, since I forgot to close my mic. Hey, Brian, welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob. My God, I that story just blew me away, the Battle of Blair Mountain. I got to tell you, I know a lot about history, and I've studied for years at Harvard Extension School, Harvard University, and all over the Internet, of course, many books I've read on history. I'm an itinerant scholar, to say the least. That's my...
No, it's obvious in your calls that you make a very, very concerted attempt to know from whence you speak, Brian.
Yeah. My God, that story of... I'm ashamed I don't know about the history of this battle of Blair Mountain and what's going on here. I'm looking at... Like right now, because you had this gentleman, was Appalachia State University?
Yeah, down in Boone, North Carolina.
Okay, that's where... And I was trying to look it up on the Internet as you were interviewing that good man there. I found something about the Battle of Blair Mountain at Roanoke.com. I think it's the Roanoke Times. That's kind of that area. That's kind of on the Carolina, West Virginia, or Virginia border or something?
Roanoke is and up a bit from West Virginia.
Okay, but it's just something that had something about the history of the Battle of Blair Mountain. And just going over that, I was trying to look it up some other stuff there. Right here in New Hampshire, in Raymond, New Hampshire, where I live, we have the old, in my little three-quarter acre lot here, they have the old stone walls there that separate each house there, going back to the pre-colonial English times there. And I remember one day I found a number of things here. I haven't used a metal detector yet, but my old yard, I don't want to cut down. I'm a tree hugger. I don't want to cut down all the trees. But it's like you're saying, even in a small, and like I've told you, you know this too, how trees are very important to stopping floods. We've had too many floods in some of the low-lying areas of Raymond because they overbuilt. They cut every tree down. But the fact is, one 12-inch round tree can take away 70,000 gallons of water even in a light rain or in a moderate rainstorm. But anyway, walking around my yard here, I found it has to be an old Indian arrowhead, and I'm guessing it would have to be an Abenaki. It may be the Mi'kmaq, but probably Abenaki. And they might have some relations with the native, I think language-wise, especially with the
Algonquian
of your area there as well, the native peoples. And there already was, we as white people, as Irish, as I call myself non-white and all that too, there is a long history of, especially for Irish Catholics under the British Crown, being treated as subhuman. But we know the tragic case of it, of course, is on top of slavery, on top of the abuse of immigrants, on top of the abuse of these miners, the American worker for centuries, it's disgusting. The Native American people were already here. There already was an established colonial civilization, a great civilization here, tens of thousands of years before the first white man set foot in the, I guess, in the Caribbean Isles.
And one of the things you find out, especially with the modern scholarship, Brian, is that the American continents, North America and South America taken together, as of 1491,
right,
were the most populous continents on the planet.
Wow. And then our dams, whatever diseases we brought there. I know that Lord Amherst, too. I don't particularly like having that name. And that it's a great college, but with a great history, Amherst, Massachusetts, named after that Lord Amherst. He apparently on purpose put the smallpox into those blankets for the poor Indian people there.
It's on and on, and it's both continents, and it's all the land in between. Knowing what a voracious reader you are, Brian.
Yeah.
Let me recommend to you Charles C. Mann, M-A-N-N,
okay.
Charles C. Mann's 1491.
Okay.
It will absolutely it'll split your skull. It will blow your mind wide open to consider what was here and what was lost.
And that they're still doing it today. They don't give a damn just for an hourly wage, or there's something like a living wage for you folks in that area of the country that to blow up mountains. That's really, you guys know better than I do, but that ain't real coal mining, right? That's not real coal mining.
No, not by any stretch of the imagination. Not one of those
Mother Nature like
not
that.
One of those 10,000 who marched on Logan in 1921 would recognize mountaintop removal as any sort of mining. It's just heavy equipment operation done dirty and done cheap.
Okay, I'm going to go back over this stuff. I'm going to let you get the other callers, and God love the great people of West Virginia, Bob. I wanted to, you know what, you know, one quick thing, you know how I love William Faulkner, this Mississippi writer. I believe he's the greatest American novelist. Mark Twain is a charming man, and he was a good humanitarian man. But, you know, Huck Finn and those stories are, they're great American stories, but Absalom, his story there is Thomas Sutton, the character there. He's originally from West Virginia.
Yes.
And his Scottish mother there, the rest of the family, only her sister, his, you know, Thomas Sutton's aunt when he was a young boy, he ran away at age 14 to become a real adventurer and a real financier and a real, and he just was the young America then in the early 19th century. But he left West Virginia, but his mom there was Scottish ancestry. He couldn't understand a word she ever said. She only spoke Gaelic. only his aunt could speak to his mother.
What Faulkner is addressing there, Brian, is the general settlement pattern that happens among the Scotch-Irish. Or Scots-Irish. They arrive largely in Pennsylvania and the Virginias, and then there's this arc sweep of them down through the Carolinas into Georgia, and eventually into the Tennessee, Kentucky, Alabama, Mississippi, and over into Texas, with a lot of settlement patterns coming down from Missouri into Texas as well, as I'm sure horn psychotherapist Rick Goodner could tell you.
Another thing I just could say, like some of your other callers can appreciate this too, that his being a working class Scotch Irish or whatever his Thomas Sutton, part of his ancestry was Scottish, obviously, but he was a working class poor white beneath working class white person basically, and the story starts out Absalom early on where he's a young boy, he goes to some plantation and they had him there. I think West Virginia then still was for the last few years before it would break off from Virginia, but at the plantation there, the black servant, you know, slave, but the black servant, very well dressed, you know, at the higher echelon of the servants, I guess, of the slave class of his time, he wouldn't allow the poor white kid to come to the front door. This poor white had to go around to the back door where they got their deliveries and where they threw out their trash and that kind of, you know?
Yeah.
And that's what Thomas Sutton had to deal with that. And so the remains, the biggest power, the biggest, most corrupting color in this country by far is still cash, green, and a lot of these so-called leading families in America, they didn't really earn the money. The American worker built with their sweat and their stress and their mind and back-breaking work and their health-destroying work, like the coal miners, God love them, they built their profits for these Rockefellers and the rest. They need to remember that. Maybe Jay Rockefeller, he kind of tries to remember that. I don't know. I'm not too much in your local politics, but the Bush family certainly doesn't seem to care about that at all. But I just wanted to add one quick thing there. You know, Brian, I got to add a stupid joke there, but you probably have heard this. You know, and like in the Caribbean was probably the first where the first white men arrived. And like the Carib Indians, you know, Kevin and your other, he might be interested in this. He probably knows that being Jamaican ancestry. There's a lot of African ancestry that came before, like the Asian, you know, come across the Bering Strait. They're Asiatic Native Americans. And you look at the map of the South America, juts almost into Africa, to West Africa, and many storms would bring African fishermen onto the coast of, you know, if they were lucky enough to survive, onto the coast of South America. And there were some settlements there. And I know, especially in the Caribbean, some of the Native American peoples there have African blood and had nothing to do with it. Was before the slaves arrived there, too. They already had their own civilization, the Carib people there. But you can go into the Black Athena book there. That tells a lot about that, the book Black Athena. But the one thing, it's something, you call me Brian Henny Youngman for the stupid joke there, but when the first white people arrived there, whether it's off the coast of Massachusetts there, 1620, or the coast of Virginia, or Columbus in 1492 and the Native Americans see them in the Caribbean. The one thing they all said there in their own native languages is, oh, they said, oh no, here they come. Here they come. Oh, there goes the neighborhood.
Yep.
Oh.
Well, it's like that great T-shirt that's out there, Brian, that shows four Plains Indians on horseback, and it says fighting terrorism since 1492.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Without a doubt. Well, let me add to my suggested reading list.
Okay.
When you get done with 1491, then the next thing you want to have in hand, because this really will enhance your appreciation for the region, you want Jeff Bigger's book, The United States of Appalachia.
Okay, The United States of Appalachia. Okay.
Yeah, that's it. And that, I mean, for anybody who would understand what this region has done for this country, and with damn near no recompense for it, that book is a must-own. There are stories in there that will absolutely blow your mind. My particular favorite is the story of Ann Royal, America's first blogger.
Really?
Yeah, in the early 19th century. She had no money, but she cobbled together a used printing press and had a team of volunteers. And they printed what was at the time considered a scandal sheet called the
probably had something to do with either workers' rights.
No. It had a very novel name. You'll find it out when you read the book. But okay. She was absolutely a thorn in the side of big ugly the business interested government and religion. She was a heroine, and she was a West Virginian, a Virginian at the time. But she was an Appalachian through and through. Brian, I'm going to roll on, but thank you very much for your observations, and we will talk soon.
Great information tonight, Bob. I'm going to go into that some more on the Blair Mountain, especially in the other information you gave me. You have a good night, sir.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
And there is a vast amount of historical information on the Battle of Blair Mountain out there, and that's part of what makes preserving Blair Mountain itself so important. And again, but just like Brian, who is a consumer, and I don't mean that in the negative sense, a consumer of historical information, that seminal event in American history, unlike any other, is not taught. It ought to be taught alongside the Battle of Bunker Hill or Breed's Hill or Gettysburg, but it isn't. Because, as has been observed, there's a 5-page section in the newspaper of business news. There's not even a 1-page section in the newspaper of labor news. And that's a fact. Onward we go. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, hello from Mississippi.
Hey, glad to know you made it.
I did. I didn't get any snow, but a lot of freezing cold. But anyway, it's good to be home. My living situation down here has changed considerably domestically, and so it's a little more pleasant than it was December or something last year. So anyway, it's good to be home. And I don't know how to segue. I just wanted to give a postcard from the road, and while it was still on my mind.
Well, you don't necessarily have to segue. We can do a hard edit and start fresh.
Okay. I wanted to start with the state of the economy that I noticed coming across country. It's about 2,000 miles door to door, and there's a lot to see out there coming across Texas for 40 days. One of the most striking things to me was, you know, those blue commercial signs that says food, lodging, and gas at the next exit, you know, and the little advertising signs are on the blue sign.
Yeah.
Those are, there may be, like, it say food, and there will be, like, 4 or 6 plaques on the sign. A lot of places they're down to 1, and all there are is just, like, 4 big old bright blue signs where they didn't put their sign up. They had to take it down. They went out of business, so they couldn't afford the cost of keep the, I think they pay the chamber of that county or that city coming up, you know, so businesses are going out of, they're just going out like crazy. It was striking. I finally noticed, I finally started taking note of how many were missing, and God, it's pretty spooky out there. And again, the, the big, well, like Ramada and Holiday Inn and all those.
Yeah, because that's what the sign always says, gas, food, lodging. And then there are three signs that follow it that are gas and then food and then lodging.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And some of the places have to have taken their signs down because they either can't afford it or they are out of business all the way across the country. And the bigger corporations are not renewing or refurbishing or restoring their big, big, humongous billboards. There'll be a lot of smaller corporations or smaller companies, but the big one, I think Ramada is maybe redoing theirs, but the rest of them are like Motel 6, they're all faded and kind of ragged looking and stuff, and I think, you know, corporate's having a big hard time too. And it just struck me as pretty odd. There was a lot of truck traffic, more than there was the last time I went through, because I-40 used to be bumper-to-bumper 18-wheelers, and one night, I mean, you used to be able to look down the road in New Mexico, and it would just be a string of lights just for miles and miles and miles. Well, the last time I went across on 40, it just wasn't so obvious. That was back in, last summer, I guess, when I went back home and up to Arizona. And now there's truck traffic has picked up quite a bit, but it's still spooky out there. Everybody's hurting really bad. The little towns are going under, and you know, what do you do with that? It's you know, they keep saying the economy's coming back, and I think back from where, you know, back to what? When is it gonna? You know what I mean? It's pretty.
Yeah, I do know what you mean, Kate, because that idea of coming back always elicits. Elicits thoughts of some sort of the golden age that never existed.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, and again, it's the jobs thing. You've got a job, but it's a, you know, if you're lucky, you know, if you're, say, housekeeping in one of those Ramada Inns or what have you, mm-hmm. you know, you might be doing a buck better than minimum wage.
And you're cleaning a room that you couldn't afford to sleep in.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even Henry Ford understood that he'd never get anywhere until he built a car that his workers could afford to buy.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and this is kind of a green news update. It kind of segues into the coal issue. Coming across Central Texas, I'm not even sure what milepost it was. Something around Bakersfield. Bakersfield, oh, yes. I was struck by, up on the plateaus, there were thousands and thousands of wind chargers, just thousands of them.
Wind turbines, sure.
Yeah. Yeah, we call them.
Were they ugly?
No, hell no. Those fields are never ugly to me. I just marvel at them. The first time I came over the hill in Livermore, California, and saw all those windmills up there, I thought, my God, it was wonderful. I mean, that was way back in the 80s or something, I don't know, 90s or something. Anyway.
Well, see, one of the objections we get around here from the babies in the We Don't Want Wind Turbines movement mm-hmm. is, well, they're ugly and they make noise and they're going to spoil the beauty of our lovely, lovely, untouched mountains.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well,
you know, pardon me, sweetheart, but you know the mountains we're dealing with down here ain't untouched, and you know, and just because they haven't come for you yet doesn't mean they won't, unless we get it stopped. And you know, the fact of the matter is, NIMBY is no longer an alternative, not in my backyard, mm-hmm. and West Virginia is going to either have wind power or coal power.
Mm-hmm.
There is not a choice C. I want a pony.
No, it's not even Hobson's choice anymore. Well, what struck me, what was so funny was up on the plateaus were all the wind turbines, and then down in the little valleys there were oil wells, and there'd be one that was pumping occasionally, and, you know, I think, oh, isn't that cute? And then pretty soon the irony just struck me. You know how I love to taste the irony in my mouth, and I just was grinning. I mean, the distribution lines are just marching through the little oil fields, and I thought it was fun, you know. I mean, I just...
Well, and what you were seeing was a very physical manifestation of a statistical reality from the last year. There were more jobs created in wind and solar in the United States than were created in coal.
Mm-hmm.
or in oil, or maybe in both of them combined. Now, we'll have to excise natural gas from that because of the discovery of the Marcellus Shale and all of the problems that that brings. But the oil and coal are on the way out.
Yeah, well, I thought I was being, well, anyway, I pulled into this little Chevron gas station. There's nothing else out there, nothing, but this little Chevron station and a little grocery store thing. And I pulled in, and I went in, and I'm making the assumption that people see things the way I do. And I introduced myself to the woman and made friendly for a minute and then said, don't you just love the irony of all the windmills up on the plateaus and the mesas and the oil fields down below that? And she said, yeah. And I thought, uh-oh, I'm going to walk into something. I'm going to have to figure
yeah,
it out.
Yeah, just got
to
keep walking.
Maybe I'll buy an ice cream bar and leave. I don't know. And she said, I said, who owns the, who is the county making any money from the wind? And she said, I don't know. I said, well, who owns the fields up there on the mesas? And she said, well, and she points south, and she said, BP owns all that. And over here is Florida Energy, and they were supposed to put 11 fields up there, and she points toward the BP windmills. And she said, and now they're only putting in two, thanks to your president. And I thought, what'd I say? I don't, and she said,
Well, don't you know that saying that windmills are not a sign of the apocalypse and little spinning pinwheels for the devil? When you don't say that, Kate, you indicate that you're a greeniac.
I know. I made an assumption based on cultural ignorance, and I just so she went on to tell me about the how the man sold his land up there for $2 million to put the wind things up, and then they didn't put them up because of the president. They were going to put 11, and now they're only putting two, and they're not putting any on his land because of the taxes they have to pay to China for the stuff that they make in China, and the taxes went up, so now they can't afford to put the wind. And she just went on and on and on. And I said, well, yeah, that's pitiful, ain't it? And she said, in the oil fields, she said, Pecos County used to have 185 pumping wells, and now we've got 11. Damn.
Never really dawned on her that maybe those things played out.
Well, no, some of them, no, not all of them, but no, that just they just had to stop pumping because there was evidently nowhere to sell the oil or something. And, you know, so it was, it wasn't depleted resources. It was other economy kind of things. And she just was not happy. I mean, she was not a pleasant person. And I thought, well, I didn't understand the culture.
No, you didn't understand the Moran.
Well, I don't know that. She said she was born here and left for a while and then came back in the 80s. And she lives down the road and 20 miles over there.
So maybe if she hadn't left and come back, if she'd just stayed there the whole time, Kate, she would have experienced the full lovely panoply of the boom and bust cycle of a hydrocarbon economy, whether it be coal or oil or gas. There's always a boom and always a bust.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe she would have had a different attitude and said, well, we're on the bust side of it again. Done it
yeah.
to us some more.
Yeah, it's that president you elected.
Yeah, what we need's a nice ignorant oil man like we had for the last 8 years. Damn it.
Yeah, I didn't even want to go there. But it struck me that BP owns the plateaus on the south side of the highway, and on the north side, Florida Energy owns them. And I said, does the county make any money from these? And she said, well, I don't know. I suppose a little bit of taxes, but I don't think it's that much. And I didn't understand any of that. So I just backed out of the conversation and headed on to Galveston. And now
don't make me do my Glenn Campbell impression.
No, God, don't, please. When Hurricane Ike came through there on September 10 in 08, it blew out Galveston, and I suppose everybody's seen that on TV. I don't know that anybody, because I didn't follow it. I think I was probably over here at the time when Ike hit. No, yeah, probably. I don't remember. Anyway, because they all start looking alike, and I was curious about what kind of rebuild was going on in Galveston and Bolivar Peninsula, and I was saddened. I wasn't surprised. But all of the haves are in their beautiful homes on the water, and their 13-foot pilings in their houses. They're running from 150 up, and way more than that. And they're all rebuilt, you know. I mean, everybody's sort of back in, and, you know, and I thought, wow. And I was driving down Broadway, which is the street, the main street that runs right through the island, and I thought, this isn't right. And I glanced down a side street, and I saw, oh, there's the neighborhood I'm looking for, the more impoverished, marginal neighborhoods. Not a thing's being done. People are living in substandard houses. Some of them haven't been even, there were some that were closed up that I know haven't even been mucked out or gutted. And people are just living in those conditions. It's just kind of like it was when I got here in 07 on the Gulf Coast, in Mississippi. And what was struck me was if you looked in just the right direction toward the water, you could see the superstructure of the big ship. And I said, wow, what's that over there? And I went over, and two cruise ships were in. And so the people who live down in the bottoms, the marginalized people, the cruise ship, you can just see the cruise ships from their yard. You know, it's just, and I went down there, and they had, the passengers were all kind of wandering around downtown, and there's a few little corridors with kitschy art rip-off, the tourist kind of places, and people were just kind of wandering around, I guess, just to get off the boat and go see what Galveston's like. And it was, the irony was just, oh, it was so sad. It was just sad. And I went into Texas City, and you have to drive through the refineries to get off of the highway into town. And I went, turned left right at the edge of where the first street was, right at the edge of the oil refineries, and checked out those streets. And there's a lot of people who just aren't back. You know, they're just living in wrecked houses. And the folks don't even know about Galveston and Bolivar Peninsula. I mean, it's like that came and went, and I don't know how much press it got, but it's just pitiful. And that, and the way people are having to live is just so, it's just so sad. I hear people say, this can't be America. Well, it is.
And it has been for a long damn time, Kate.
Just, you know, hurricanes happen, and the people who, the haves, are back in their houses.
It doesn't even take, no offense, it doesn't even take a hurricane to get poor people shat on.
No. And they are, and just, it's just pretty miserable. And I guess I thought I was used to all that, and I'm getting a better sense of, I mean, this trip, coming through the place where I wasn't familiar with the culture nor the hurricane nor the damage, I had a physiological, spiritual, and emotional response, and I have a better appreciation for my visitors who come down and see New Orleans and Pascagoula and Lost Point, and you know that.
Well, if you were traveling I-10, you must have shot through New Orleans too.
No, I took 12 over to Baton Rouge.
Yeah.
Because
shot around.
I didn't want to go that far south. I needed to get back into town and before 2 or 3 in the afternoon. So no, I didn't go. I'm going back over to visit my friend, and while I'm down here in a week or two or something, I don't know. But and I'm really not looking forward to going back to New Orleans. And I told my friend while ago, I said we were talking about food or something, and I said something, and she said, oh, you're back home. And I said, no, I beat that to death. I never did leave. Oh, the crystal. I said, I never have quit talking about crystal. and I said, there's a lot of news about rebuild and about this and that and the new agency, and the agency for the Living Independently, L-I-F-E, Living Independently something. They just passed out hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of grants, and Life didn't get a grant. I was just appalled. They didn't get. Oh.
Well, you know, and we talk about miserable things happening to poor folks. I haven't mentioned it on the show this evening, and it seems an appropriate place to mention it. But apparently, hell has yawned wide open, Kate, in the nation of Haiti.
Oh, my friend just stuck her head in the door and said, "You said there's having an earthquake because I've got a kid that's going. You know, I haven't been feeling very good all day." And she said they just had a 7.8 in Haiti, and I said, "Yep, I knew that." And they had an earthquake. I said my knee tells me that we had one in California, Northern California or Southern California too. So. And I said, boy, Haiti's going to need help down there. And she said, that's right. It was pretty awful. I haven't seen any of the footage yet.
There are a few places in the Western Hemisphere that could least tolerate a disaster of that magnitude than Haiti. Mexican historian, or a political figure rather, historical figure, Porfirio Diaz, who said, poor Mexico, so far from God, so near to the United States. But the same can be said of so many other nations near us. You know, poor Haiti, so far from God, so near to the United States. And if you ever pick up a copy of Jared Diamond's Collapse, Haiti is one of his case studies. Because it's just an abject warning to us all. What happens when we let a mercantilist, colonialist corporate mindset completely rape a country or decimate a country? I hate using that other word.
Yeah, I know. One of the things that struck me about, you know, speaking of corporatists, but one of the things that struck me is that Galveston, where the rebuild has been done so beautifully, and all the people in their fancy cars and their pretty houses, and they live in Ron Paul's congressional district. And I thought, I wonder how, since the hurricane was only in September of 08, and what is this? This was like December of 09, so it's been a year and, four months, something. And I wondered if living in his congressional district had anything to do with, you know, if there's any political influence like there is down here. I checked out, where's our money? Did we get any? I've been out of Mississippi for almost a year now because I went to New Orleans, and I said, has any of the grant home money, the grant money that we got from the government and all that for Mississippi Rebuild, has any of that been kicked loose? And she said, nope, not a bit. Haley's taking good care of it. So the agencies are a mess down here, and the clients are still hurting, and this thing now on to something a little bit different.
Well, let me interject just real quick. You will be pleased to know, I just saw this posted in the chat room. Sparky posted it. Apparently, if you were in Pecos County, Texas, it's entirely possible some of those wind turbines you saw were not corporate owned, were not owned by BP or Florida, whomever. In Pecos County, up on Indian Mesa, there is a wind farm that is a function of a local cooperative.
Oh, okay.
Green energy business called Wind Energy 7, a green energy business dedicated to rural, residential, and community wind power technology.
Oh, okay. Well, I hope that one of those fields was that one.
83 megawatts. I mean, they're not, they ain't just whistling the Yellow Rose of Texas.
Who happened to be a high yellow lady who was just pretty wonderful. And the correct pronunciation is Pecos, not Pecos. You're talking like an outsider.
Well, I have never claimed to be a Texican.
Me either. I just had an aunt live there one time.
Pecos, Pecos.
Pecos. Pecos County, yeah. I heard somebody last night, I'm still wandering around in the archives and catching up, and I heard the remark made that Brad Pitt rebuilt Ninth Ward, and I went straight freaking up. Straight up. And I clenched my jaw, And I said, what? A little profanity there.
You mean it was followed by the and another word?
Uh-huh, whatever. I don't know what that... I just wanted to set the record straight that Brad Pitt came in with whatever her name is, and they, like, lived there for a little bit and made a big splash and, bad choice of words. And the houses that he was going to rebuild are, like, right on the levee. I mean, right on the levee. And the lots were completely scrubbed. Oh, Bolivar Island, that was what I was going to say. Bolivar Peninsula was scrubbed just about as bad as Pascagoula. And there's not a whole lot of rebuild going on there right yet. That's a more of a lower income than Galveston is. And so...
And it turned out I misspoke. The gay bar of famous repute that was the only thing left standing was in Galveston, not on Padre. Did you get a chance to pay a visit of Thanksgiving?
Mm-hmm.
No, I mean, did you get a chance? I mean, did you see it?
No, I didn't. I didn't want to spend any more time there than I had to. I just wanted to drive through and get a perspective, narrow perspective based on my experience. It's totally subjective. I don't know anything about nothing. I don't know what Bolivar looked like before it happened. I don't know what Galveston looked like. I don't know nothing about nothing except I just know what hurricane damage looks like, and I know what rebuild or the lack thereof looks like, and it's pretty pitiful. And I know what blue.
Well, nice to know our bettors are doing well.
Mm-hmm. I was pleased for them. I mean, I have a real hard time with not being judgmental. Like, how come they've got everything and these people have nothing? I have a really, really...
Well, that's because God likes them better.
I know. And I just have a hard time with that. So,
take it up with God. Or at least that's what they tell you.
Go straight to God. Anyway, when Brad Pitt went in to do this Make It Right thing, they were going to build green homes and... you had to own, they were going to build 150 houses, and they were going to be solar and well-insulated and have the specially treated insulation and stuff that was, and the materials were all mold and termite resistant and all that, you know, and they were built them up on stilts and, you know, it because that's the city code now that you have to build when you're that close to the water or at a certain elevation. At least here in Mississippi, you have to build a certain, you have regulations, and so some places have to be 20 feet, and other people have to be 13 feet off of the ground, and other people only need to be 6, and, you know, it just depends on the elevation and the location, and the Corps of Engineers makes those maps, and then the county and the state enforce the regulations, blah, 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 blah. Well, and the people who are getting houses have to own the property where the house is being built. They have to be able to pay the taxes and the insurance on the house and be able to pay the mortgage. And if they are not well off enough to pay the mortgage, they get subsidized by the fund or the, I don't know, something to do with the Make It Right people. Well, he came in and made this big splash and then left, and they were going to build 150 houses.
Right, and they're apparently up to 14.
Oh, I thought it was 5 when I left.
I'm looking at their website right now.
Oh, they have 14 now.
They've got 14 areas. They have 27 homes plotted on their map.
Okay, so they're up to 14. They're up to 14 that moved in? Okay, that's good, because there were only 5 when I left last June or July.
And apparently they're still at it.
Yeah, well, the other objection that I had to, that I felt really uncomfortable with is that they're not culturally relevant. They could have used the Creole cottage style that was more culturally relevant. Those were climate friendly, you know, and they could have made them solar and all that. But they built these ugly looking beach house things that are all geometrically they're just goofy looking. And a lot of people are saying it just looks like a upscale suburb with no trees. I mean, these streets used to be tree lined and it got, they got completely scrubbed. I mean, that property down there is just devastated. But they put these ugly houses up that are just, they aren't culturally, they're not, you know, they're just ugly. They don't fit the culture. You know,
But what was there before? I mean, there was a lot of, I mean,
shotgun houses.
Yeah.
And little,
I mean, isn't this a step up? I mean, I'm not being argumentative, but isn't it a step forward?
Well, when I say shotgun, I mean, there's some shotgun houses that are just, that doesn't mean it was decrepit and dilapidated and fallen down with the roof caving in. It means that was the style of the house. And then there's another one called a saddlebag house that are, they're lovely, you know, and the Creole cottages, they could have put those in. They could have done something that wasn't this big. Yeah, they're better than nothing, okay? But when they come in with all these big old, big city white boy ideas and the big construction companies and the contractors, and they just, I don't know that they even consulted with the locals about what they wanted the houses to look like. They just found out they were going to get greenhouses and Brad Pitt. Oh, it's Brad Pitt. You know, I don't even know who Brad Pitt is, except I got so sick of hearing him about him. And the visitors who'd come down, they want to go out. They wanted to take a tour when I was in village manager over there. I want to take a tour. So, okay, well, I'll show you this and that. And I had a little, what's it called, a cook's tour. And we'd get in the van or the truck, and they'd want to go see Brad Pitt's houses. And I got to be such a bitch. I'd say, who? And they'd say, well, Brad Pitt. And I said, who's that? And they'd say, well, you know, he's building all those houses over there. And we wanted to go see them. I said, I don't know who that is nor where they're at. And I just, I said, if you could draw me a map, I could take you by wherever the neighborhood is, you know, if it's in Ninth Ward. Well, I don't know. It's just he's down here. I got so sick. All they wanted to see was Brad Pitt houses, and so I had a particular bad taste in my mouth about. But when I heard someone say that Brad Pitt rebuilt Ninth Ward, I thought I really need to call in.
Yeah, it's going to take more than any one individual to rebuild the Ninth Ward. I mean, there has been some fascinating thought going on down there. I followed a piece several months back that I heard about on NPR, where one architectural design firm had literally designed a house that, in the instance of something like the aftermath of Katrina when the levees broke, would float. And you know what? That ain't a bad idea.
Wasn't that on the Brad Pitt website?
No, it was on NPR when I heard it, and it wasn't associated with Brad Pitt.
I think he probably wants his name taken off of it. I think it had something to do with the contractors that were working with him, and I think they called it a floating adobe house or something like that. So, yeah, that's not a bad idea, but what does that say about the levees?
Well, I mean, but we know that they, and, you know, that's another one of those things that we're sort of waiting around to see if President Obama will, you know, just, you know, drop a little note to the Army Corps and say, you know, I think we ought to just do these levees for level 6. I don't care if you say there ain't a level 6. There probably will be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the levees are not even back up to speed, back up to par. They're not even safe in it yet. Not yet. So it's going to be a mess.
You know, we were talking about Haiti a moment ago.
Mm-hmm.
I got an email in just now from Juanita, who always these observations from the course of a life lived. Juanita says, when I was a member of the 700 Club, Pat Robertson said the reason Haiti was so poor was that when they received freedom, they had promised their country to the devil through voodoo. That was when they got free of France. Juanita notes, I've since learned that voodoo is rather an honorable religion, Vodan, and point of fact, many Haitians are, oddly enough, Christian. Juanita says, I weep for the people of Haiti. We have many Haitians who live here in Florida, and I am blessed to know some of them personally.
Yeah.
We are having sinkholes down here in Florida The weatherman I saw said it was probably caused by the excess watering by the farmers trying to save their crops. I don't know. Signed, Juanita.
It's her Haitian friends practicing voodoo.
Voodoo sinkholes.
Love me some voodoo. Ooh, honey. Makes me want to just drop everything and get over to New Orleans tonight, you know? I got to stop and eat some rice and shrimp, though, before I go.
And by the way, Juanita adds to my correcting my ignorance. She says shotgun houses are usually built on long, narrow lots and have great, unique floor plans.
Yeah, yeah. They're wonderful. Yep. Some of the houses that have people have come back and, you know, they gutted theirs and then rebuilt it because the foundation was pretty good, or they jacked it up and put it back up on blocks, and some of them are just wonderful. I mean, the architecture and the decor and the way people gussy up their houses on the outside, I mean, it's just a treat to drive up and down the streets. Especially when I had my brother with me, and I could go in places that, you know, white girls didn't even want to go into. And we'd drive through the neighborhood, and we'd wave, and, you know, people would nod, and they'd look at us kind of funny, like, who's that? But as long as I had my friend Alan with me, we went places.
and I should let you know, the chat room is working overtime tonight. It has been suggested to me both from Marty via email and then this via Sparky. The floating homes idea is apparently a carryover from an architectural design that is quite caught on in densely populated low-lying areas of the Netherlands. And this article I just got from Treehugger says one Dutch construction company, Dura Vermeer, has developed homes that can float with rising waters. 37 of these homes line the waterfront at, and my pronunciation of Dutch is horrible, so Maasbommel or Meesbommel. Paneled in blue, yellow, and green. They have a hollow concrete cube at the base to give them buoyancy. And the next time the Meuse River bursts its banks, the houses will rise with it.
Wow.
And electricity and water are pumped in through flexible pipes. And the houses can withstand a rise in the water table of up to 13 feet. And sadly, they started about £180,000 or $310,000.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Oddly enough, demand is high.
Yeah,
and they're dang cute. Got little sloping roofs and stuff, and
sure, if it's the only house you've got to buy forever, buy. You know, if you live in those conditions, it's the last house you're ever going to have to buy. I guess that would be worth it. I don't know. My big concern, I just, all this is political and money and grants and road home money is not coming back and make it right. Pulled out, and would you say there's 11 now, and there's 20? I need to write that down.
Well, just go to makeitright.org or makeitright.com, and you can see the numbers right there.
Okay. Anyway, my specific concern right now is for the people who don't have housing and they can't get into Section 8 housing, and the waiting lists are like 4,000.
Well, Section 8 housing has become almost impossible in New Orleans, hasn't it?
I'm talking about Mississippi. I'm talking about New Orleans.
Well, but I mean Mississippi too, because mm-hmm. one of the advantages that that came with that hurricane, if you can imagine, is that people who slumlords who own Section 8 homes suddenly got to do different with their property, and suddenly they're not Section 8 homes anymore.
If I understand correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people got their rebuild money or got their grants, their FEMA grants or whatever, and rebuilt the house and put it up for sale. Well, so there's lots and lots of property down here that's just clearly it's a rebuild house and, you know, nice little brand new little house and a big for sale sign out in front. So, you know, people just bailing. You know, I guess that's what I do, but... Hell, I keep coming back. Anyway, got to move on. I guess dinner's ready, and it's the top of the next hour. Boy, it's late already. So
it does run on by sometimes, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
This is going to wind up being a six-hour show. I know it. I'm going to be so tired. I don't mean this show, but I mean, sooner or later, I got to expand.
You have to leave them wanting more. Don't do. You keep talking about expanding the show. Don't. No.
It's not that. It's not about leaving them wanting more, Kate. It's about I ain't getting to all the stuff I got to get to on a given day. And by the time I get to Friday, I can't clear the stacks.
Well, you could have cut me off about 20 minutes ago and
cleared. I'll be damned if I'm going to do that. It won't be conversation radio anymore.
I see. Well, quit calling it conversation radio then.
No, because I've done invented that.
Quit making your stacks so high.
I don't make the stacks high. The universe makes my stacks high.
I'm a systems design person, and if there's a glitch in your system, it's a design flaw you have here, and you're calling it the wrong thing. So anyway, conversation radio, and you just have a few little things that you can make things up on the fly. You don't need stacks, and we listen to Malloy and all those other people, and we don't have to worry about. You don't have to catch us up on the news. But you know, we've all heard it already today. I don't. Joking.
I guess I'm going to have to get a banjo and sing.
Oh, sing that pretty Jimmy Buffy song again tonight. Oh, my God, that was a great song.
Yeah, I love that. I heard that first time Friday evening after the show and just fell in love with it.
Yeah, me too.
That would be the one from last night.
Hmm?
That would be. I was just telling the rest of the gang that would be the one from last night.
Oh, yeah. Well, anyway, I'm going to leave it at that. So y'all have a good night. Hug the redhead for me, and thanks for taking the call.
I sure will. I wait all night for calls like these.
I know you do.
Later. Bye. Kate, back where she belongs on the Mississippi Gulf Coast. We are at the top of the hour, but I see no sense in breaking stuff up. Let's keep rolling. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob. It's Preston.
Hey, Preston. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you?
Getting along.
Yeah.
I was trying to stay warm. You know, here this is the damnedest winter. I mean, I know you live in Denver and stuff, and you're used to seeing some snow and so forth in the winter, and you know, so are we to a certain extent. But it's been eons since the snow fell and didn't go away. We haven't seen the ground here since Jesus before Christmas.
Likewise, we've had a couple unusual cold snaps. But maybe some warm weather is on its way, because today it was, I think, 60 degrees here.
You're kidding.
No. So it's quite the pendulum, for sure.
Oh, we got all of it, like 18.
It's, oh, wow.
Yeah, it's nasty cold here, and it stayed that way. I mean, the nights are getting down to, you know, 5 and 8 and so forth with a wind chill of God knows what, and because you said cold snaps, and I was about to respond by saying, well, you know, you're in Denver, cold snap means something really different there, and apparently it means 50. I'm being a smart aleck, but...
Yeah, it was down to zero-ish, you know, for a couple days there. You know, our normal high this time of year is still kind of mild, more mild than most people think it is. It's around 40 degrees, typically, and the sun's very warming. And the snow is usually gone in a couple days.
But so when does the ugly stuff come? Is that late January, February, into early March kind of thing?
Yeah, I think March is actually tends to be our snowiest month. The coldest one is usually, late January, February, I guess.
Well, that's like Kate talking about being down on the Gulf Coast and how cold it was as she drove across and stuff. You know, I read a statistic one time that one of my favorite places on earth, Gulf Shores, Alabama, has like 4 days a year where it's below 32 degrees Fahrenheit. And it's been a lot more, going to wind up being a lot more than that this year.
Okay. Yeah. I did see an interesting, you know, and of course people like Hannity have, you know, seized upon this cold snap here and also in Europe, China as well, and you know, of course, using it to argue against the concept of global warming or climate change.
Right.
So, but I saw a recent some statistic about, you know, how they've, you know, people kind of confuse the weather with the climate, you know, long-term, you know, short-term anomalies with long-term trends. And the trends are very curious, to be sure. And I think it's just so shameful how Hannity and people like that present these issues. And I'd be more than happy for Al Gore and James Hansen and people like that to be wrong. But I think they really do deserve to be heard out you know, it's too important an issue for people like Hannity to be so irresponsibly and recklessly misrepresenting the issue.
No, it's so true. And, you know, I was over at Crooks and Liars earlier today, Preston, and I saw, I guess they had a little contest for what to name Sarah Palin's new show on Fox.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm grateful for the giggles that I get here and there. Whoever won the contest suggested the name Box of Rocks on Fox. Because, you know, she is dumber than a box of rocks.
Yeah, and she's been another one whose attitude regarding the environment and industry is just let it rip. You know, what was their big motto? Drill here, drill now.
Drill baby, drill.
Yeah, all that stuff. Again, I saw the film Avatar, and they're the spokespeople for the sky people, I guess you could say. And, such a disregard. It's a real shame to see. And they're so vulnerable, though. I mean, give James Hansen, I mean, can you imagine if, like, Randy Rhoads spoke with James Hansen for an hour or two on a weekly basis? Hannity and those people would have some answering to do. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
There are enough people, enough right-wingers listening to Randy's show where if they were to hear this person speak for himself, and if he were to take calls from these people, that's what happened on a community radio station here. He just has a book out called Storms of My Grandchildren or something like that. Not getting a lot of press like Sarah Palin's book.
You just really, really touched on something there. And with all due respect to Randy or anybody else in similar circumstances, I don't know if the format really admits of, you know, long-form conversation.
I wondered about that, too. And I wonder what, you know, some of her, you know, I'm sure she experiences a lot of pressure to, I don't know.
Well, remember, she's working.
Particular format.
She's working for Premiere now.
Okay.
And you know who Premiere is? Premiere is Rush Limbaugh. Premiere is Jim Rome.
Okay.
Premiere is. I think she's the only thing approaching liberal, or the only liberal that Premiere has anything to do with.
Yep. And I do appreciate a lot of what she does, but there are problems with that format. Not allowing particular voices on, and also kind of the pattern of the this side versus that side. She had a caller that pointed that out recently, that it was like the Dems versus the Republicans, and we're going to stick to that, and we're not going to think about popular movements going on, which I think is by far the most hopeful thing we've got going in the society. You know, people are really putting the progress in the word progressive. The people doing the organic farming, the people starting the renewable energy businesses, the people questioning big pharma, consumers movements of all sorts. They have to have bigger platforms. Even NPR. NPR has been really disappointing the past couple of weeks, you know, ever since the underwear bomber guy. Every single morning, you know, I wake up oftentimes to NPR on my alarm. And it's taken about 30 seconds, like every single day for the past 2 weeks, for them to start talking about the terror bomber, the Christmas bombing plot, the
19- Oh, I, oh, oh, Preston, I know. And I'm glad, you sort of confirmed something for me that makes me feel like I'm not out there in the hinterlands by myself. Namely that there's just not that much to say about the Undie Bomber. There's a lot to wonder about, and God knows, there's an entire universe's worth of speculation on it, but there just isn't that much news. And I said it, I guess, a week or so ago that I tuned in and I heard Malloy simply take apart the whole Undie Bomber story like some sort of yogi disassembling a spider web, and once he had done, I felt like it was done, and there was really nothing more to say about it.
Yeah, yeah. are, you know, they could at least expand the discussion about, you know, again, the blowback issue. If we're really serious about our security, we've got to have a serious discussion about why there are people who would be driven to something as...
I mean, would it really, really do NPR that much harm if they devoted just a little bit of the time that they have otherwise devoted to the Undie bomber to this ongoing story of the slaughter of school children in Afghanistan by U.S.-led forces?
Yeah.
I mean, could we talk about that? I mean, I don't even want a whole show about it, but could we at least talk about it to the American people? Because if one of these terrestrial, over-the-air, mainstream, and NPR is mainstream, media outlets would break this story, then the others would fall into line and start asking questions, too.
Yep.
You know, but instead I've got, what? I've got NBC's Chuck Todd, who is tweeting, and literally, I think we have finally found the absolute perfect, the pitch perfect definition of what it means to tweet. Because this is tweeting, if anything is. I've got Chuck Todd tweeting as follows. And remember, this is the guy who said we and conservatives and referred to other Muslim leaders after referring to President Obama. Chuck, and you know, this guy's up way up on the food chain at NBC.
Yeah.
You know, he's what, senior White House correspondent or some such.
Mm-hmm.
And he tweeted the following. Why is Reed surviving while Lott didn't? Dems are rallying around Reed. GOPers let Lott wither on vine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
See, I'm about to get caught up in talking about Harry Reid, but just, oh, for the love of God, please.
Yeah.
It's not that simple. And it's not the same thing. It's not apples and apples or oranges and oranges. Comparing Trent Lott and Harry Reid's various comments is comparing what? Apples and light bulbs.
Yeah, and it's also the perfect sort of issue to throw out there to have people beat each up, fight over. It's a kind of divisive issue where, you know, both sides can have a plausibility of their arguments, in a sense. And it's very, it's a distraction. It's a big distraction. In fact, when the Trent Lott comment, you know, I think I would have liked to have seen a more substantial overview of the policies he was behind, not this particular comment of his either. I mean,
yeah, he was plenty hateful enough all by himself without the squirrely adoration of that vile old maid rapist.
Yeah, and he was that, and he was also, you know, I think in some regards a fair person, you know. I think there's more to even some of these right wingers, especially on a personal level, where they aren't caricatures either. So I don't know.
Well, and every succeeding generation of right wing extremists makes us look back like that at Trent Lott by comparison, he wasn't so bad.
Yeah. Well, let me give you an example. There was a politician in, I think, North Carolina. He's the guy who coined the phrase freedom fries. You know, we're not going to call them French fries.
Yeah, freedom toast.
Right. And, you know, he got a lot of grief for that, and I think deservedly so. But I think what's lesser known, but I think very important to know, was that shortly afterwards, had a change of heart about the war on Iraq.
Yeah, that was Walter Jones, wasn't it?
Okay, that sounds right. Yeah, he's been talking about, you know, bring the troops home. And here we are, all this suffering, all this death and destruction, and $1 trillion later, when you combine Iraq, $700 billion, Afghanistan, almost $300 billion. You know, it's just been a huge transfer of wealth from the general public to the war elite, the war party elite. What a racket. So anyway, to have a right winger like that we can point to as progressives and say, look, there are people who are Republican right wingers who in moments, you know, will have some integrity.
There are blind hogs who occasionally find an acorn.
There you go.
I'm sorry, that's very negative of me, but it's the way it feels sometimes.
You know, I'm certainly not a big fan of groups like the CIA. I mean, you know, the overthrows and the invasions of privacy and, you know, all sorts of stuff. But there are people within the CIA who are talking about climate change as a national security issue, an international security issue. Again, can you imagine if this on NPR or National Progressive Talk Radio, we had James Woolsey talking about climate change to all you manipulated, sanitized people? Take this guy on. You know, you're such worshippers of authority and these secret agencies. Here, this one's talking about climate change.
Yeah,
the insanity you have to say to him.
Right, and yet the ongoing smear against Mr. Suthers, the proposed TSA chief that Jim Demented and Jim Inhofe and that crowd are holding up. You know why he's being held up? Let's see. Here's one of the attacks. TSA nominee said global warming deserves parity with war on terror. So, you know, they're having a fit about that. Here's another one of their talking points. Obama TSA nominee Errol Suthers calls pro-life advocates terrorists in video. Well, you know what? Fact of the matter is, Preston, so-called pro-life advocates can be terrorists. What else do you say? What do you call the guy who murdered Dr. Tiller?
Yep, and the FBI says that these right-wing white supremacist militias are the biggest domestic terrorist threat that we face.
Yeah. Let's see. Here's another one of their attack points. TSA nominee in 2008, alliances with Israel, France, make us subject to terror attack. Well, there's never been a right-winger born who cared about anything about France. But, you know, oh, what? Our alliance with Israel could open us to terror attack? Heaven forfend.
Yeah. And our support of occupation and, you know, the siege on Gaza, yeah. It's, you know, alliance sounds much better than to call it what it is. You know, our oppression of Palestinians makes us subject to terrorist attacks.
Right, yeah. And beyond that, what you get from the right wing, what that's a manifestation of, Preston, is the ceaseless willingness of the right wing to stick its fingers in its collective ears and go, la 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 la, can't hear you, not listening, la 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 la. When you're trying to explain to them that it's not just some sort of absurdist, Camus-esque sort of thing where terrorists just throw a dart at the wall and, well, it's us this time.
Mm-hmm.
That's not how it happens. These things happen for a daggum reason.
Mm-hmm.
And I keep going back to Joe Bajant's article from a couple of weeks back because anybody who hasn't read it oughta. Where he said most Americans have still not realized that, oddly enough, all the terrorists happen to come from the places with oil underneath them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, is it too much? I mean, I realize that self-awareness, is especially given last night's show and that quote from Bull Durham that Marty provided us with, I realize that self-awareness is not our long suit, okay? But the fact that, can we have a little bit of it? I mean,
yeah.
Because the right wing always screams, you know, if we say on our side, Preston, anything along the lines of perhaps it might be well if we actually understood the culture from which the terrorists are arising, the right wing says, oh, you just want to have psychotherapy with them and give them a hug.
Yeah.
No, I don't want to give them a hug. I want to find out why they're doing this.
Yep. Those attitudes, those dismissive attitudes, you know, on top of all the misinformation. You know, the right wing's done a great job of just cultivating these dismissive attitudes when you try to have a serious conversation with somebody about a whole range of issues. You know, we can have a more serious conversation about airplane safety. I mean, during the span, you know, just a few weeks, you know, in the past month or so, you know, the underwear bomber isn't the only thing that almost killed a bunch of people on the airplane. We've had like 3 or 4 jets get off the runway. Just a couple days ago, there's an airplane that their landing gear on one side malfunctioned, so they, you know, bumped around on one side. Recently here in Denver, we had a plane needing to pull out of its landing because there was already a plane on that runway. and on and on. And we're not having much. We're not having NPR's not waking us up every single day talking about airline equipment, the workload of pilots.
No.
Remember when I think it was that pilot Sully who landed that plane in the Hudson River? You know, he testified before Congress on this issue. You know how they're being worked to death, their union's under assault, they're going through payroll reform and all that kind of stuff. The United Pilots here, they totally got robbed of their benefits. You know, these issues that have, you know, a regular effect on our well-being with this mode of transportation. But it doesn't sell, you know, GE's scanning equipment. You know, that narrative won't bring money to the people who want to create this surveillance state, police state, this anti-Arab state, anti-Muslim attitude. That doesn't feed into that stuff. So we've got to bring it up ourselves. Really, it's going to be more of a grassroots conversation because right now the media is so...
asleep at the switch.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. But the part of the media that's awake, it's fun to see and it's fun to support. I was just at a new website I found called Mother News Network, I think it's called,
mm-hmm.
or Mother Nature Network. I think the drummer for the Rolling Stones, or not the Rolling Stones, I think it was the drummer.
Charlie Watts?
Not him. That's not right. So I think somebody with the Rolling Stones, though, one of their musicians, had something to do with starting it up, so to speak, and you know, put some funding for this website. And I'll look into that. But anyway, they've got a list of the top 10 environmental books of 2009. You know, it's fun to see, and they noted what a deluge of publications and articles and books that are coming out regarding these issues. So we're not, you know, we don't have the platform and the profile of the much of the electronic media, certainly not the 24-hour news networks who are too busy with Balloon Boy and Tiger Woods. But there's this other sort of media in print or certainly on the internet that is just massive and growing very quickly. Some of the books they mention as the top ones is Al Gore's Our Choice. What else? A book called Climate Cover-Up, which was written by a person very much involved in the PR industry himself. That's his profession, James Hogan. But he was so disgusted by what his profession was doing regarding climate change, denying it, that he came out, wrote this book called Climate Cover-Up, The Crusade to Deny Global Warming, and he exposed people in his industry of public relations about what they're doing, how they're doing it.
How odd it is, that these sorts of revelations seem to be coming from, they seem to self-generate out of the PR industry, because wasn't it a the healthcare guy that was with Aetna, he was their PR guy.
The corporate communications person for Cigna, actually.
Was it Cigna? Okay.
But
how interesting that, and, you know, we could wonder if psychologically that's because these guys are on the front lines of doing the lying.
Yeah.
And that after a while, if there's any sort of conscience involved, it becomes an issue of no longer being able to live with oneself.
That's right. And he's honest about that. I forget his name, too, but he talked about how he was living the high life, you know, riding around on the private jets and the fancy silverware and great meals and lobster and all that stuff. And then he attended or stumbled upon a healthcare fair in his home state, I think, of Tennessee. And he was just appalled by what he was seeing, how desperate people were, how long people had gone for getting treatment for all sorts of things. And he was done with it. And, I mean, you know, that's a good thing that national progressive radio has been doing. People like Ed Schultz have been interviewing him on a pretty regular basis. So again, I have my critiques of.
And now, of course, the news comes out, and I don't know why this is news to anybody. The big pharma or the healthcare companies mainly gave something on the order of $20 million to these so-called anti-healthcare reform groups that were funding ads. The story as it's being reported says that money between $10 million and $20 million came from Aetna, Cigna, Humana, Kaiser Foundation and Health Plans, United Health Group, and WellPoint, according to two healthcare lobbyists familiar with the transactions. The companies are all members of the powerful trade group America's Health Insurance Plans. The funds were solicited by AHIP and funneled to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce to help underwrite tens of millions of dollars of television ads by two business coalitions set up and subsidized by the chamber. Each insurer kicked in at least $1 million, and some gave multi-million dollar donations. And that's breaking now. Now it's entirely a matter of speculation as to how much time that story will get as compared to, say, Balloon Boy or the Tiger Woods.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't know this.
Yeah. Wendell Potter.
Yes.
Okay.
I kept wanting to say Wilbur, but I'm glad I didn't.
Yeah. And, you know, the ways in which we could have a more serious discussion about security, again, the right wing loves to brand themselves as the party, security, they always criticize a nanny state, where the government, God forbid, does something nurturing and education and food and health care.
Or actually lives up to its constitutional mandate to promote the general welfare.
Yeah.
Because, see, right now we're engaged in promoting the specific welfare. And that is not in the Constitution.
Yep, the corporate welfare. But they have no problem with the daddy state, or more precisely, kind of this violent, drunken daddy state. Just send the money to Vegas and to war and to, whatever daddy might, give them a reason to bash someone in the face. They're all for that daddy state, okay. But, war, and more war. They're all over the place. It's amazing. Funneling all this money to Halliburton and, give them a reason to set up some torture chamber and Gitmo. And, that's another thing about Limbaugh, that he and his audience, they can pretend to be so anti-government that they applaud the government when it sets up these secret gulags. I mean, where government can be ugly and abusive, they love it. They're all over that. It's the government that might do something for the people. Or, yesterday I heard Limbaugh going on about government jobs. He was so upset because public employees, they don't have the same, they're not suffering the same cuts and firings. I mean, that's going on for sure, but just not at the level that he's happy with. And so he wants to destroy those unions. It's amazing. It's just what a freak show to watch these right-wing lunatics.
No, it is. And again, going back to the theme that we've been working, Preston, it is not made any better by a more or less dead Fourth Estate. I just got forwarded a link by News Ninja Gene from Glenn Greenwald's column at Salon entitled "The Fundamental Unreliability of America's Media." I mean, that's almost Zen-like in its purity. But he says, consider the record of the American media over the last 2 weeks alone. Justin Elliott of TPM documents how an absolute falsehood about the attempted Christmas Day airline bombing, that Abdul-Muttalib purchased a one-way ticket to the U.S. when it was actually a round-trip ticket, and goes on to document these other. And what you have here is a situation in which the for-profit media stops doing reporting. That's at the ground level, that's what this is. This is non-reporting. This is not going out and doing your job. So if the New York Times reports that it was a one-way ticket, then the Washington Post can report it was a one-way ticket, then, and on and on and on and on. And nobody ever checks until somebody at a blog site does the work instead. And what that phenomenon is a matter of media reporting on other media and sort of veiling it as news.
Mm-hmm.
When it's not. It's gossip.
Yeah.
You know, unverified allegations are gossip, not news.
Yeah. That's right. That's right.
So you're right. I mean, we've got to build what we want. But our job is made about 10 times as difficult as it ought to have to be by virtue of the fact that we spend so much time, where it's possible, trying to correct the overt falsehoods that have already been generated.
That's right. You know, build what we want, reclaim what's ours. You know, these airwaves, they're ours. They're the public's property. You know, again, that's why people like Limbaugh and his directors, they hate public stuff. They don't want a public sphere. Not in media, not in school. They hate the public schools. You know, John Dewey helped to found the public teachers union, school teachers union. They've been after that for decades. Certainly they don't like public libraries or public TV. They don't even want public seeds for food. They
have
privatized and patented, and Monsanto is, you know, they're explicit about how they want to privatize the food system, and they're on their way. And they've got people like Clarence Thomas, who was a lawyer for Monsanto when he was in.
But by the way, and I got to see if I can get my hands on this thing because I really want to try to bring it to the horn. Thank heaven for people like Michael Pollan.
Yes, indeed.
This new book out called Food Rules: An Eater's Manual.
Mm-hmm.
I just saw a write up of it in the New York Times health section. And it's from Penguin, I got to get him on the show. But more than that, you know, the purpose of getting people on the show to talk about books like this is to encourage people to go out and obtain the book, or get it at the library, or you know, whatever source, so that you can put this stuff into play.
Yeah, definitely.
Because this is the only rampart against the Monsantoization of your supper.
Yeah. Yep. If we just put it in play, you know, between our own ears, that's a step forward. You know, but we have friends and family we can talk to and coworkers. Sometimes we're teachers. Sometimes we're professors. Sometimes we're people that call into radio shows. Oh, incidentally, speaking of grassroots media efforts, Limbaugh got a call yesterday from a guy who challenged him on the Harry Reid stuff, and he's like, this is a distraction. You all don't have anything to contribute. You have no plans, and you know, we need to get the economy going, and you know, stuff like that. And then Limbaugh, you could tell he's flustered, and he said, my screener, he said, we're getting a spam with an army of these callers, you know, and they're calling all radio stations. So apparently there's more of that kind of activism, media activism going on. And I can tell by Hannity, too, he's taking very few calls. They sound frightened. You know, they huff and puff, and they're very...
Yeah, because their echo chamber's got a couple of dents in it now.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But that didn't slow Rupert down from signing, Caribou Barbie.
Yeah, yeah, that's true, that's true. And I wanted to add... They try to project an image of confidence and authority, but they're scared. But anyway, in addition to people like Michael Pollan, real recently at the Denver Public Library, and if you can't afford lots of books, the library, you know, and the library keeps track of who's checking out what. And if we're checking out progressive material, okay, but it can make a good argument as to why their budget should go to more progressive material. And what I checked out recently, just a couple days ago, was audiobook on CD by Barbara Kingsolver.
Yes.
Love that last name. How are we going to solve this issue of, you know, unjust monarchy?
Right.
But Barbara Kingsolver wrote a book in addition to her wonderful novels and radical novels. She wrote a nonfiction book called... Animal Vegetable Miracle, and about...
It wasn't that about her and her family's attempt to garden their ground?
That's right. And if they, whatever they couldn't grow themselves, they would buy within a 5-mile radius from local farmers,
Well, do you know this thing going on, oddly enough, right here in West Virginia? A year or so ago, or within the last year, Huntington, West Virginia was declared the unhealthiest city in America. The same time that Burlington, Vermont was named the healthiest. And they pointed out, you know, same size towns. On the other hand, Burlington, Vermont has places that you can get organic food and places where you can eat a vegetarian meal. And Huntington has a hot dog festival.
Mm-hmm. That will do it.
They've got Burlington's got a longer lifespan. They eat a more varied diet. They've got a better economy. They've got better jobs. The jobs that are available, they have better jobs. Huntington has coal.
Yep.
And, you know, various and sundry other assorted poisons as well. Mm-hmm. So, enter the picture, Jamie Oliver. You know who Jamie Oliver is?
No, it's not ringing a bell.
He's the chef from Food Network who talks a little bit like that Geico lizard.
Okay.
And he's just this charming young man with a really big, good heart, and he has gone to Huntington, West Virginia. And set up shop, and he's redesigning redesigning school lunch programs, going into hospitals, doing teaching, showing that there's more to eating than a hot dog.
Mm-hmm.
And if it works, it'll be a game changer. And lo and behold, I guess it's Cabell Huntington Hospital is, and you know, maybe this is some sort of for-profit affair, the PR feel good, probably, you know, there's some sort of that sleaze involved in all of this. But lo and behold, local television here is awash in Cabell Huntington. This is a healthy eating minute from Cabell Huntington, and there's Jamie Oliver talking about how he wants to help the hillbillies eat better.
Great. Yeah, this is another sort of real news, real conversation.
Yeah, he was the naked chef. That's it, the naked chef. Thanks, John Fox.
Okay, excellent.
And he was a delight. And he was a delight to watch back when I had the Food Network.
Yeah, what does Michael Pollan say? Something about there's no such thing as cheap food, you know, because of the expense that.
Oh right, he says. Cheap food this book of his is divided into thirds.
Mm-hmm.
And it's based on something he said in a previous book, in which he said in his book In Defense of Food, he had a simple rule: eat food, not too much, mostly plants. And so he built this latest book around those three tenets: eat food, not too much, mostly plants. And so there are 64 rules, if you will. You know, telling a liberal there's a rule, that's dodgy. There are 64 rules about, you know, just how to go about the business of eating. And he starts off with the premise and says in this article in the New York Times health section, we know there's a deep reservoir of food wisdom out there, or else humans would not have survived to the extent we have. Much of this food wisdom is worth preserving and reviving and heeding. So he engaged in, I guess, what you would call an open source project, to coin a phrase, in which he invited folklorists, anthropologists, doctors, nurses, nutritionists, and dietitians, as well as a large number of mothers and grandmothers, to submit to him rules that he could then distill into this little tome. And, you know, it's funny and it's cute, and there's one... there's one that he points to as he says as an evidence of the fun side of it. Don't eat cereal that changes the color of your milk.
Right. Yeah.
And right. Yes. Yeah. You know, if your kid's breakfast cereal has just turned sky blue pink,
mm-hmm.
something turned it sky blue pink because there aren't any sky blue pink cattle.
Yeah. And, you know, this is so much even more than a health concern, you know, food and health, and there's all sorts of economics, but there's, you know, it's a huge political issue. I remember Thomas Jefferson, he spoke a lot about the importance of small, you know, decentralized farming arrangements for a lot of reasons, something I'm going to look more into myself, but the policy. politics of it all, and, you know, the importance of biodiversity, you know, that we've got all these mega monocultures all around, make them very susceptible to being, wiped out by, the virus or something in the plant world. So again, another very real national security issue that there should be discussions about, that, the people who, who are selling stuff at Lockheed Martin aren't interested in. You know, they've got helicopters, attack helicopters and things like that to sell, not, food biodiversity, not heirloom seeds or something like that.
Right, exactly. You know, what went on in Iraq where the Bush administration, and I don't know, for all I know, they succeeded in getting GM seeds into the cradle of agriculture.
Yeah, yeah. They're right when they say it's not just about oil. It is about oil, but it's also about control of food supplies in places like the Middle East. Iraq had rules against importation of foreign food supplies, not corporate food supplies.
Speaking of corporate food supplies, just check out some of these rules from the Pollen book. If it came from a plant, eat it. If it was made in a plant, don't. It's not food if it's served through the window of your car. It's not food if it's called by the same name in every language, like Big Mac, Cheetos, Pringles.
Mm-hmm.
That's so true. If it comes from a plant, eat it. If it was made in a plant, don't.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is, these are things that are very, very easy to do if you have the wherewithal to do them. A lot of this is about providing basic, even if it's garbage calories, basic calorie consumption for a vast, poor population.
Yes.
You know what? You can't, I'm sorry, if you're living in the projects, Preston, you're not going to go out and get the Belgian endive radicchio salad with fresh cold pressed grape seed oil vinaigrette raspberry sauce.
Right, and you don't have a Whole Foods within walking distance.
No, and Whole Foods is a whole nother.
Yeah.
I got a Whole Foods story here from Alternet. Is Whole Foods bad for the planet?
There are definitely issues with Whole Foods. Again, that's Whole Foods though is also complex, and I think the CEO is wrong on a lot of things, but
well, apparently he's wrong and getting wronger.
Yeah.
There's no such thing as climate change.
Mm-hmm. The health care reform.
No health care for you. So basically, here's a guy who's arguing against two of the most important things that liberals have on their agenda, and he's rich enough to propel these arguments by virtue of the fact that liberals largely have made him that way by going to his organic food store.
Yeah, and I remember there was even a boycott called against the store when he made that comment about, he wrote that piece, I think, in the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times against the healthcare reform. And again, I think it's, and Whole Foods is more than just that person. There's a lot of people, I know a lot of people who were in the previous natural food store, and they actually feel they get treated a lot better by Whole Foods. They like their participation and decisions and their compensation more. And there are all kinds of small farmers who have a place to sell their stuff, and there's fair trade coffee available, and there's a broader range of magazines. So I think for those reasons, I think on the whole, a place like Whole Foods is very good. I'm still critical of it in some ways, but it is out of reach for some people, but because it can be expensive. But as people learn, something else Michael Pollan says is that we should be paying more for food. And I'm not talking about the poorest, but, middle class type people, it should be a bigger investment, because what you support with your dollars, how you're voting with your dollars, how much do you want to support your own health? I mean, that's worth a larger investment oftentimes. That maybe those of us who do have some resources, should invest in. We're in some sense, we're costing ourselves a lot when we're eating a lot of 99-cent hamburgers in terms of...
it's that economy of scale thing that one of these days I'm going to just take 2 weeks off and understand, because it baffles me. Well, it doesn't baffle me. I want to learn the process whereby we can have a 99-cent hamburger.
Yeah.
You know, and have it all trucked in on a diesel truck from, you know, eventually, you know, thousands of miles away. If you read the label on the ground beef in your local Wally World or whatever, it'll say things like, this hamburger may be comprised of ground beef from cattle originating in North America, the United States, Canada, Mexico, Argentina, Chile, or Australia.
Mm-hmm. And I certainly...
Wow.
Yeah. You know, some of it's still getting made from, you know, chopped down Amazon jungle.
I'll have to get to it at some other point, but I've got a chopped down Amazon jungle story here that is absolutely mind blowing. It, you know, as dangerous as it is, by the same token, it has just yielded some fascinating information, Preston. But I've got to roll on right now because I've got a couple of blinkers I want to hit before the show's out.
Two other real quick points.
Yeah, go ahead.
And regarding Avatar, there's an argument, and there are criticisms of Avatar that I think are legitimate and people should think about. And one of them is this story that there's a racist subtext. Regarding.
Yeah, why does the white guy always have to save the day?
Yeah. Okay, yes. I'm not even going to say that's not an accurate assertion. But I would say that, a number of things about that. You know, in many ways, the Navi, the indigenous people, saved him.
Very much.
Okay. Also, nature itself had a lot to do with kind of turning the battle around when they were trying to repel the military, the conquerors, you know, who were coming to take...
Yeah, because the God stepped in.
Yeah.
Awa has heard your plea. Remember that line?
Yeah. Yeah, so you saw it.
Yeah,
too.
Yeah, I did.
Great.
And that's when it's a very derivative film, too. That's when the Tarzan scene takes place and the elephants and the rhinoceroses start rumbling through the jungle. Oh, that's a spoiler. I better shut up.
Yeah.
But, you know, one of the things that Agnes pointed out about, because, you know, it was, we go see a movie together because we have to take out a boat loan to do it about once every 2 years. And it really has to be something, and we usually go for, you know, the big screen spectacle, you know, that you don't want to watch on something the size of a computer monitor.
Mm-hmm.
And so, hence, we went to Avatar, and it was really cute watching Ferg trying to knock the falling ash away from the front of his face, you know, in front of his glasses, you know, that wasn't there.
Right.
I remember circumstances in which I did that didn't involve 3D movies, but never mind. But anyway, one of the things that Agnes observed was... Why is it that Jake Sully, in the year 2154, when it is made clear that the technology exists to give his legs back, and he is in fact a disabled veteran of the Marine Corps of somebody, the United States has never said, no matter how many right wingers have a screaming piss fit about it, the words United States Marine Corps is never said. It's just he's a Marine. And I know it. I know it's a contradiction of our national hubris, Preston. But other countries have Marine Corps too. But the impression that the right wingers, well, it's just an indictment of being America and loving business and capitalism. But it's 2154. This guy is a disabled veteran, and he's still in a wheelchair, and the technology exists to put him on his feet again. What does that say about James Cameron's vision of, if we are to assume it's the United States, James Cameron's vision of what is going to happen even to disabled veterans in the future? That their benefits are going to be cut and cut and cut and cut and cut.
Yeah, unless they, you know, continue to do favors, you know, for the state, you know, and that was the thing. We'll get your legs back if you, you know, be an infiltrator, infiltrate the Navi for us and get us intel for them. Yeah,
and bear in mind, even as a function, if they've got the function to do this as a function of space travel, then the civilization also, by definition, has the ability to leave human beings, as Agnes just noted to me, in stasis for a matter of years. Imagine, you know, there was that line in the movie, on my planet, we've already cut down all our trees.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Well, on that plant, they probably cut down that tree, those trees, because they have needed room for the stasis prisons that they've built. You know, one of the great elements of a storyteller is that in telling the story that's in front of your face, he can make you wonder about the story that's behind it. And I kept thinking, you know, what does Earth look like in 2154 in this world where they can build alien bodies, where they can fix legs, but don't unless you do nefarious favors for the state.
Right. You know, another issue I had with it was in how in 2154, you know, an educated person like, you know, Sigourney Weaver, who plays this biologist and scientist, comes out of her pod and is clamoring for a cigarette. I don't think she'll be doing that. I don't think she'd be asking for like a cup of kava maybe, or some cot from Yemen.
Nah, I think she still wants the butt.
I'm just joking.
Because it was funny.
Organic tobacco, at least.
But, well, the terrible thing was, is when she said that, I realized I needed one too.
I'm sure a lot of people were feeling that.
Yeah, there were four or five of us standing outside the front of the theater, freezing our asses off, smoking a cigarette in a movie that cost $11 to get into.
It was a long film to sit through without that fix.
You're darn straight.
And one last comment on the cost of healthy eating. You know, farmers markets can be expensive, but they can be a real deal. Also, if you're buying the right stuff, if you're buying in bulk, it can be more affordable. Urban gardens, you know, people like Majora Carter are very sympathetic and sensitive to people's money issues around healthy food, so they're pushing the urban gardens, the community gardens, community-supported agriculture projects. They can, for a small investment, you get a lot of food back. There's a website called localharvest.org where people can get connected with all, there are like 5,000 different projects around the country. And lastly, Barbara Kingsolver. I had a feel for what she did in that book, Animal, Vegetable, and Miracle. I didn't know this, and I thought of you when I found this out. Her family, where they live and when they're doing this project, it's from their farm in southern Appalachia. I believe Virginia, but
yes,
I'm not
it is
sure.
Virginia.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. So
it's an amazing place if it can be left alone to support human beings instead of coal companies, Preston. It really is.
Yeah, have more respectful relationships with the land.
Exactly, and you know that's where it starts with. You know, that's part and parcel of what Dr. Ayers is doing. You know, you have a little respect for your history. You have a little bit of respect for your heritage, and you know, there's some land that it just becomes hallowed. You know, Abraham Lincoln said in the Gettysburg Address, no one will remember what we said here today. We do not hallow this ground. It has already been hallowed by the sacrifices made upon it. And the same thing applies to Blair Mountain. So,
yeah.
Well, thank you very much, Preston, and I've really enjoyed the conversation.
And thank you, Diane, for the prints.
Oh, you got them.
Yes.
Wonderful, wonderful.
And thank you for your kind note, Diane. I appreciate that. So, good night, everybody.
All right. Take care, Preston. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
From Denver, not freezing, that's our buddy Preston, and onward we go. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Buzz.
Hey, what's up, Gene?
Oh, a couple of quick things before I get to what I was actually going to talk about. You do realize that the whole thing with Avatar, and I'll bet you, even though I haven't seen the movie except on extra legal means, those are probably all corporate states. They've replaced.
Well, you know, there wasn't a flag, but, yeah, it's not taken... But those are, so...
I'll bet you that if you look on the cutting room floor, it would have said, you could find a scene that says, welcome to the, we are our Marines of Z, or whatever that Blackwater's called now.
That is not a bad observation at all.
Yeah.
Because it's all left very unspoken.
And that's why Sigourney Weaver can still want a cigarette, because, you know...
Because corporations are still out there producing cigarettes.
Yeah, and the bits with Venezuela and Nigeria, those are probably the last two nation states on the planet that held out until I don't know. Anyway,
that have unfully exploited oil resources.
Yeah, and therefore they still have somewhat national government, maybe, or not. Anyway, a couple other, one other quick thing, and then I'll go on to what I was talking about. You know, as you were talking to Preston, I was thinking of that quote by George W. Bush that they hate us for our freedoms that we always laugh at.
Yes.
And I would submit to you, if you turn that around, the right-wingers are actually saying we hate the liberals for their freedoms. Their freedom's not to buy the stuff that we sell. And it kind of leads
Ooh.
And it kind of leads into what I kind of called about, because there was this article I read about the credit card companies. But they're going to try and put in these new fees and junk, you know, after the Congress went ahead and, you know, slapped a cap on the
predatory practices.
Yeah. So
I got that link from you. You're talking about the 6 new credit card booby traps on the way?
Yeah, and now here's my question. Why is it considered, why would I be considered to have bad credit if I simply close the account and continue to pay on it on time? I don't understand. Can you explain to me what's the logic? You know, if I decided, as long as I'm paying the credit card off, why am I considered to have bad credit if I just close an account?
Well, because they get to make the rules.
Well,
I mean, I know that's overly simplistic, Gene, but it's the truth.
I guess so, but I was thinking when I read it, it's like, okay, we're just going to have to, and I've lived with bad credit before, you know, and I don't know if I could do it now, because now they're cutting out all the, they're cutting all the public, you know, that public, as far as I can say, the public sector was basically where you could go to and still survive when everybody was out, and everybody else is out there with their hand out saying, pay us. And see, I always look at this, like this whole thing with the public sector and everything else, and how they pushed to ruin basically the government and privatize all this and that and all the other drugs. These are all just trying to open up new markets because the markets that they were in are saturated.
Well, yeah, they are. And the other thing that they're doing also is after this, incredibly moderate bill, I wouldn't even call it moderate, it's just conservative bill, was passed, the credit card companies immediately sent into action their army, and it is an army, Gene, of lawyers.
Oh, I know it.
Who were handed a copy of the bill and said, you find the loophole. And what I found most disturbing out of that that article you sent me about the 6 new credit card booby traps on the way was number 5, new fees. This is the most alarming area of all. Overall, I think fees is the big word for 2010. It's a quote. There are people dreaming up fees right now that you and I have never heard of.
Yeah, and see, I'm almost to the point where it's like we've talked about, you know, this whole thing about Arianna Huffington and the local bank move, which I think is great. But it's like, when are we going to do this for credit cards? I mean, I'm almost tempted to do, like, set up, like, a card. I don't know the first time I do it, so I probably couldn't meet it. But, you know, set up a cartel for people to say, you know what, I'll take you a lousy bad credit rating and just leave you hanging and you can just eat it.
Well, or the other side, you know, there are other business models out there, Gene. And frankly, as we go forward, you know, maybe one of the remedies to that is the cooperative approach to credit cards.
Yeah.
You know, they don't actually have a legal monopoly on that. People can get into it if they have the assets to support them.
I know.
So, you know, that's a possibility.
Because it's my whole, the thing I really hate about this whole crap, because I don't care, you know, they've said that there's been some talk that the class war was over. It's like bull crap. It's never going to be over.
It's never going to end.
Yeah. In that part, Marx is right. So, I mean, it's just, I see no contradiction in using, I know, I'm sorry to sound like a, something of a, kind of a, I feel good with the term. I'm a left-wing conservative. I see no problem with using market mechanisms to achieve social So,
well, no, they use market mechanisms to achieve their social dominance. Why can't we?
Hell yeah, and they also use social mechanisms to do, you know, they use our crap all the time. It's like turning around. So but again, when you were talking about that, it's like for sure when George Bush, going back to the other thing, when George Bush says they hate us for our freedoms, he was really saying, we hate you progressives for you, because you're free. You're free not to buy our crap. You're free not to be scared of us. You're free.
Because you're calling us on our BS.
Yeah. Yeah. And then,
well, you know, Ron in Raleigh just pointed out to me via email, Gene. He says, remember, Bob, the middle class is just poor people with good credit.
Yeah. Yeah. And
I think that wins our trenchant observation of the war of the night award.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Rod. Thank you, Rod. Thank you. You know, that is a, but man, I saw that and we just gotta learn to either move with bad credit for a while or find some alternative or something. I agree with Preston. The third part, the progressive stuff that's not necessarily party oriented sounds awfully, awfully neat. Anyway, I will let you go because I know you got other people.
Well, unfortunately, I've also got to get out of here. But thank you. Thank you, Gene. Take care. Bye now.
Bye.
News Ninja Gene, the man who reads the internet every day, all of it. And we are at 2 minutes before the hour, and I apologize for all the blinking lights. I hate to leave them blinking, but I don't want to get in the way of Malloy. It's time to switch over to him for everybody, including me. Thanks for your contributions this evening, your ideas, your thoughts, your calls, your emails. And thank you to those of you especially, or not especially, but also who listen to the program in delay after Malloy, who then share your thoughts with us. I really do appreciate that. Thanks for the encouragement and the reinforcement. It's important because this is one of those mediums where, this is one of those media where you can't see the audience out beyond the footlights and they don't line up with the red carpet. So feedback is really, really good, and reinforcement and positive reinforcement really works on me. So that's not me being desperate. That's me being appreciative. I got several emails talking about how people were snorting various liquids out of their noses when I was making light of conservative humorist Matt Labash. And I've got another example of that, so maybe we'll find time for it tomorrow night during prayer meeting. So thanks again to everybody. Thanks to John Fox and Peter Godbold and Ben Birch. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and coalriverwind.org. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you.
Cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy!
Don't believe it.
Tonight edition of The Horn, and we're going to get right to business because, well, there's breaking news in the coal fields, and it's in its way heartbreaking breaking news. Here in a few minutes, we will be talking with archaeologist Dr. Harvard Ayers, professor emeritus of archaeology and anthropology at Appalachian State University in Boone, North Carolina. Dr. Harvard Ayers has been instrumental in the fight to save one of America's most needed and most neglected historic sites. I'm talking about, of course, Blair Mountain in southern West Virginia. Most of you most likely know the story of Blair Mountain. You know how working people who were, for lack of a better term, and I don't know that there is one, who were enslaved by the rising coal industry in this state. By the end of the second decade of the 20th century, had become fed up with the idea that they were fit for nothing more than bond servants of a coal industry that treated them as something less than human. As such, eventually these working people pushed to the absolute breaking point, marched. They were marching toward Logan, West Virginia, the seat of all that was evil and unholy in what the coal industry was trying to do to keep, at that time, working people under their thumbs and in a state of utter terror and absolute repression. These are not idle words. What preceded the armed march on Logan? Matewan preceded the armed march on Logan. The murder of Sheriff Sid Hatfield on the courthouse steps by gun thugs on the courthouse steps of McDowell County, West Virginia, preceded the armed march on Logan. The New River Coal Wars preceded the armed march on Logan. The Bull Moose Special, in which the coal companies hired a train to literally go down Paint Creek Holler, machine gunning everything in sight, preceded the march on Logan. And it came to a head not at Logan, but at Blair Mountain. Coal miners who recently had been involved in what they were told was a fight to make the world safe for democracy in Europe took up arms again as they marched. They were met at Blair Mountain by the unholy host of corporate coal company gun thugs, aided and abetted by the state government and the federal government. They entrenched and they were attacked. This story should be taught in every American history class in the United States from eighth grade up. Eighth grade is the year when West Virginia kids learn West Virginia history. And there is barely a word about the rise of the labor movement in this state or the struggle for fundamental basic human rights in West Virginia. I should know. I've got an eighth grader studying for the Golden Horseshoe exam now. He has heard nothing of Blair Mountain. Fast forward in time. Blair Mountain, where the federal government, the United States military,
at the urging of one Billy Mitchell, who would go down in infamy, sent its fledgling Air Force carrying bombs to drop bombs on working Americans. Blair Mountain. Blair Mountain receded into the dim mists of time to a certain extent. Remembered, but not remembered. The fledgling union movement in West Virginia following Blair Mountain was crushed until, in the midst of the Great Depression, the National Labor Relations Act was passed. And collective bargaining was legalized as a matter of statutory law. Now, consider that for a moment. Back up.